So here is actually the strategy which saved the book but created perplexion. I would like to insist, and this is a very important issue, the controversy is not over even today. For reasons you understand later, but I would like to give you an example which is maybe to a certain extent known. Until 11 or 12 years ago, there was a major figure in intellectual Israeli life named Isaiah Olaevich. He was Maimonides' reviews. Someone who accepted Maimonides in a sharp manner. He was giving lectures in whatever part of Israel by any invitation in any place, having this vision of Maimonidean in a most pure manner. Now, for him, all the Jews he knew are idolaters. That's, he put it very openly, you know, in discussions. And it was a very interesting experience to start to discuss with him and ask him, rabbi after rabbi, are all those rabbis idolaters? For sure, say, for sure, what the meaning? All are idolaters. So for him, there was only one real Jew in the history of Judaism. Even Moses is not sure. So it was Maimonides. So it was a major part of the Israeli intellectual scene. It was not an exception. Excuse me? It was an issue which took place for many, many years. And here you could see how the controversy. Now, most of the people in Israel, for sure, I didn't buy something like that at all. They wouldn't even discuss with it. It was anathema. But here we have the resurgence of Maimonides by claiming openly the idolatry, which is widespread, in fact much more, in Judaism. So this exclusive vision was not only a matter of Maimonides, it remained part and parcel, and we're going to discuss much more of other Jewish philosophers. Of many other Jews who bought Maimonides as their major mentor or guide. And I should mention some of them, but I cannot enter too much, because I'd like to discuss the alternative to Maimonides. So Maimonides was so great in the way to start the other part of my discussion. He was so great that he created Maimonides, but he created also anti-Maimonides. Which means he created by his extreme approach, not only by his approach, by his extreme approach, he helped the crystallization of an alternative to Maimonides. Would he be more modest in his intention or in his claims? Maybe he would remain an important figure without creating an alternative. People would say, okay, that's his vision. We shall survive. We don't need to offer an alternative because he's going to remain in the march. He was so big that people couldn't refrain from reacting. And that's why he created also not only anti-Maimonides, which is clear, but he created also the alternatives to Maimonides, which didn't exist in such a way, and that's what I'm going to discuss now, didn't exist and couldn't exist in such a way without the challenge created by Maimonides. So, in a way, Maimonides created not only Jewish philosophy, he created also Kabbalah. When I was invited, I don't know when, 15 years, 20 years ago, to speak in the honor of Isaiah Olaevich, I didn't want, but I couldn't refuse. So I told him openly, in his presence, there were some 300-400 people. Leibovitz, you are creating Kabbalah. By your extremity, I didn't know that Madonna would come and all these stuff. It was before. But there are many people who remember it. Is that the one extreme created the other extreme. And the insistence of one extreme is almost as a law in culture, creating the other esteem. And that was created, you know, by Nehru to a certain extent, not only, but it was very nice to put it in such a way. But for sure it's true for Maimonides. Because in the middle of the debate on Maimonides, which means Maimonidean on one side and anti-Maimonidean on the other, who negated Maimonides dramatically, another camp emerged. Something which is not totally anti-Maimonidean, for sure not Maimonidean. It is conservative, but not exactly conservative. And that, what I'm going to discuss now, the emergence of a more full-fledged, inclusive theology. So, remember, I attempted to claim that in fact, some form of inclusive theology is found earlier, by God having two divine attributes, by having female manifestation and Shekhinah, by having the glory of God, having the different divine names, and even a son. I mean, there are a variety of inclusive possibilities in rabbinic theology, but no one cared to offer a systematic issue. To explain, not just to throw the Shekhinah, that's all. Don't know exactly what is going on there. Or to say that the glory of God, but what is actually the glory of God? What is the relationship? We didn't have in Judaism someone like Origen, who will write you a treatise about what is exactly the Son of God. 400 or 500 pages. So, inclusive theology was vaguely found in Judaism, but it was never presented in a systematic manner, because it was not systematic in itself, and no one took care to make it systematic. The problem is, what happens when you have such a challenge, telling you that all those beliefs are in fact idolatry? What do you do with them? You renounce. One way is to renounce, as done by the admirers of Maimonides. Say, oh, all these things are wrong. But most of the people believe that their tradition is the real tradition, not Maimonides, because they were reading the Bible, and they understood the Bible. They read their Greek literature, and they assume the Maimonides is simply wrong. So what do you do? So one way to say that he was crazy. Okay, so many people said he was crazy, he was an heretic. Yes, but that's not an alternative. The real alternative is to give a systematic alternative. Not to blame him at home. So, here I see the emergence, you know, in the middle of this sharp debate, in which the camps didn't want to compromise, because they couldn't compromise. There was another small fraction at the beginning, but became stronger and stronger and stronger, and articulated several forms of alternatives to Maimonides, but also to classical forms of Judaism. Not just Maimonides, but by the elaboration, it became an alternative to rabbinic, non-systematic sort. So, and that is the emergence of Kabbalah. In my opinion, Kabbalah is not emerging out of the blue because of Maimonides, because there was such an inclusive theology before. But it didn't exist as a systematic structure because the rabbis didn't care to be non-systematic. But in the moment they were pushed to the corner, they didn't want to be negative, only negative. And say, everything there in our text is fine, Maimonides is wrong, and if you ask me what is the Shekhinah, I don't know what to tell you, because I don't have any theory to tell you. So some people wanted to be able to explain why Maimonides is wrong, in a systematic way, and not just to say that he's an heretic, or my father was not an heretic. or my grandfather was a fanatic. So it was not an argument, it was a sensibility, if you like. So in a certain moment, we had the emergence of an alternative, but this emergence is not a simple one, meaning it's not an invention ad hoc against Maimonides. That is also not old, predating Maimonides, but something which was a negotiation with Maimonides, with his claims, and also other philosophies. Not to create something which is not Maimonidean, to a certain extent anti-Maimonidean, but taking in consideration as much as possible the older rabbinic tradition. So that's the way that I would like now to approach the emergence of the inclusive theology. So first, let me start with data about, not to be misunderstood, about the emergence of Kabbalah. So if you ask me today, I don't know what's going to be tomorrow, but today I believe that Kabbalah emerged as a literature at the end of the 12th century in Provence, the place where the polemics against Maimonides was worse than any other place. Meaning, this coincidence of debate against Maimonides and the emergence of Kabbalah, in the same time, the same place, in my opinion, must be meaningful. I don't believe in simple accidents. The place is not accidental. Have a look in medieval time, not now. What is Provence? Provence is the place where the South Europe, is meeting the North, which means the Andalusian elite is meeting with Ashkenazi elite, or French, which was basically Ashkenazi, which means that is a median place geographically, in which the two cultures represented by the extremes, one extreme in Andalusia, the other extreme in Germany, are meeting culturally. So Kabbalah emerged at the confluence of two big Jewish alternatives. One was the more, we call it rationalistic, I think you use this term until now, but there are people who believe that it's rationalistic, but let's say so. The philosophical Andalusian, strongly influenced by Arabic sources, is meeting with the French and Ashkenazi Jewish culture, which is strongly influenced by nature, by anthropomorphism, by, for sure, rituals. People who didn't care to read any philosophical book. One, not because they couldn't, because they were not around. See how many books were written in Germany in the 11th, 12th century. You see that there were not too many among Christians or in general. So we have two elites, one acculturated to Arabic culture, which is Greek culture. The other elite, different or even opposing the philosophical culture, they are meeting in the same city. There, the translations were made. So, from my point of view, as a literature, Kabbalah is a late 12th century literature. However, that is, in my opinion, only what I would call the written platform, which means we don't have documents which can be called Kabbalistic before this period. To what extent there are traditions which are Kabbalistic, but they were oral, for sure I cannot demonstrate. The Kabbalists are saying that yes, we have earlier traditions, but I didn't find, unfortunately, any document. So that's why, on the basis of the documents we have, at least for the time being, the emergence, in my opinion, can be very appropriate. It's not a historical accident. By chance, we have the first document there. But can be a historical chance. Maybe the emerge elsewhere, but Luckman's were probably. My opinion is that's not the case. What happens there, it was essential for the emergence. And that's why the first documents are found there. B. The first known historical Kabbalist is the first critique of Maimonides. Not a critique, the first critique of Maimonides. So that, in my opinion, is also very significant. It cannot be by chance. So his name is Rabbi Abraham ben David, or Rabbah de Postier, who wrote, in fact, the commentary on Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, the second like, book of Torah. Well, he was very enthusiastic about the mind of Maimonides, but when he arrives to essential places, he says, how do you dare to speak about our forefathers of the written tradition? Meaning is very, very angry and bitter, and put it very, very clearly that you are wrong. So, yeah, he's writing glossary. And there, despite the fact that he admired Maimonides. But on matters of principle, the first Kabbalist is also the first short, sharp critic. So that's, again, cannot be an accident. And that takes place in Poskia, not far away from Lunel. And this guy was apparently rich, invited the Andalusian to translate the books. Not Maimonides' book, because Maimonides' book, Guide of Prophet, was written later. But he had an interest in philosophy. He was not an obscurantist, someone who doesn't care about philosophy, doesn't want philosophy. He wanted to know about philosophy. But he didn't want philosophical Judaism, which is another story. So, this Abraham ben David, he ordered translations and apparently paid at least a part of it. But in the moment it became an alternative for Judaism, certainly that's a totally different story. So don't speak about obscurantists. People who don't want to learn anything, that's what may be the opponent of Maimonides, but not the circles I'm going to describe now. That is another story. So we have the second coincidence. Not only time and place where Kabbalah merged, we have this. But we have the same person, man, being the first Kabbalist and the first anti-Maimonides. So my assumption is that here we have a clue for understanding why Kabbalah emerged in time and place and circles from the historical point of view. Not to say that someone had a revelation there. In 1180 someone had a revelation and Kabbalah emerged. Or some unknown traditions arrived there and everything by accident emerged in the same city. So I don't buy this form of explanations. But also I don't buy the other explanation, which assumes that everything is a reaction to Maimonides. The most important Jewish historian ever, Heinrich Goetz, who wrote in the 19th century some 7-8 volumes of the history of the Jews, he liked Maimonides very much and didn't like Kabbalah. So he described Kabbalah as the obscurantist who didn't want to see the light of Maimonides. And they created that Kabbalah as an alternative . So this vision of Kabbalah didn't die, it's still very powerful among many circles. So I don't buy this vision. Because he is claiming that everything is an invention. My assumption is that we have a regrouping of the inclusive theologies mentioned earlier to be offered as an alternative to Maimonides. I should explain exactly what is this alternative, but that is in order to make it clear, you know, because people are attributing to me a variety of views. I don't believe that Kabbalah is ancient. But I don't believe also that it's an invention out of blue against Maimonides. It's something in the between. How much in the between, I don't know. But it is not a simple story to say it's an ancient text, you know, vision written at a certain moment. It's also not an invention against Maimonides. It is against Maimonides. There are earlier traditions, but that's a combination triggered by the impossible situation. You have a towering figure like Maimonides. And he's claiming what he's claiming. And we respect him, but we don't like his alternative. We would like to build a positive alternative, not a negative alternative. To say he's wrong with that. Or to say, maybe he's right here, he's wrong there. Let's offer a constructive answer to my answers. So, that is the way I'm looking to Kabbalah. Even when I'm going to tell you all the time that it's ancient, that it's ancient, that doesn't mean that I believe the Kabbalah is ancient. There are some traditions which are ancient. Some are medieval. Some are indeed created against my Maimonides. But that's not the whole story. The whole story cannot be explained in a simple way. So, let me attempt now to start with what is called, in my opinion, the inclusive theology of the Kabbalists. Despite the fact they are not the first, but they are the first from the point of view I'm going to discuss now. So, some of them said, look, Maimonides has a very sublime intellectual vision of God. He's right. But what do you do with the Bible? That makes it clear. He said, there's no problem. Let's put the philosophy on the top. There is some recondite place in the divinity that really is pure. It's intellectual. We cannot have access to it. And it's very philosophical. However, the Bible is also right. Because God is manifesting himself in corporeal, former, doesn't matter how. So meaning, there is also a manifested God, which is corresponding to the biblical Talmudic tradition. Which means that not either or, but both Maimonides and the biblical rabbinic tradition, all of them are correct. But you must understand the hierarchy. Philosophers are right by that remote God, which is existing. But we are not concerned with it. We are concerned with the Deus Revelatus, the revealed divinity. And that, from this point of view, Maimonides is for sure wrong. But he is not totally wrong. So also the Bible is right. But the Bible didn't speak about the transcendental God because it was too secret. He spoke about the revealed God. So, by creating this form of hierarchy, the Kabbalists were able, in a way, to live with Maimonides and with undergoing Maimonides by telling them, you are right and you are right. Simply, both of you don't know the whole truth. The whole truth is complex. So they created, in the beginning, a simple form of inclusive theology, which I'm going to explain in a moment more. But first, I would like to give you the principle and the way I'm looking to. And they would say, look, in an age of everyone believes in this philosophy, maybe that's true. So let's presuppose that there is a high level of existence that we don't have access to, but by speculation. And there's nothing bad about it. Only if we accept at the same time there's also a revealed divinity which can be accepted as represented by the Bible. So, in such a moment, there's no sharp choices to say this is wrong and that is wrong. Both of them are wrong, both of them are right. That's why that's a middle, if you have to call it a compromise, or a mid, or synthesis, or eclecticism, doesn't matter. What's important here, from my point of view, is that's an inclusive theology. It includes philosophy, more than one philosophy. Maybe Neoplatonist, maybe Neo-Aristotelianist, I mean, there are a lot of nuances. And you have the dynamic personal anthropomorphic God at the same time, subordinated to the philosophical one. This subordination gave to classical Judaism a respectable place. I mean, we don't worship some inexisting God. That's false. That's totally false. It's not true. In a way, I'm going to explain. The ritual is addressed to God at some level of divinity. If you like to be a philosopher and to exercise your mind to arrive, you can arrive, so that's another problem. That's validate what you are doing. But for sure, not into that. So, this inclusive theology was accepted by many, many people easily. That's for me a sign. This inclusive theology had sources. Because otherwise they would be accused of being idolaters like Maimonides. And won't the Kabbalists be able to capitalize on ideas which were, at least in part, accepted by the traditionalists? The traditionalists would tell about Zen exactly what they said about Maimonides. That's an invention, and you have no sources, and better to burn your books. But, surprisingly enough, in the middle of this sharp controversy against Maimonides, when Kabbalists started to write, no one wrote almost anything against Zen, with the exception of three or four phrases, which is nothing. Against Maimonides, books were written. Against this synthesis, we have three or four phrases. I would be glad to find a page. It would be fascinating to find a page in the period of 12, 30, or 40. Yeah. There's a surprising fact that despite this hunt of witches, and everything new was considered to be a problem because of the fear of Maimonides, a new theology emerges, and no one is saying anything, nothing bad about it. So I shall explain why later. But that is, how to put it for me, a sign that inclusive theology was possible and was important. And people could detect there at least a part of what they believed, and different people to detect different parts and live with it without being involved in this hunt against Maimonides, or to remain simply traditional. So here we have another, perhaps we call it the middle or golden mean, I don't mind, I would like not to give compliments to the Kabbalists. You have an alternative, which is a constructive, that's very important, critique of Maimonides, because they also criticize Maimonides, but not in such a sharp term. I shall give you examples in a moment, but here we have an alternative, which was constructive and developed over the years from a very small elite in Provence to becoming one of the major forms of Jewish theology over centuries, without really big controversies. So there are controversies against Kabbalah, I don't say that at all. The same Leon Ebreu that I mentioned earlier, he also at a certain moment didn't like Kabbalah, so he wrote a book against Kabbalah. Problem is he didn't dare to publish it. So he put it in his rover. And up to the 19th century no one read his book. So that is the example of when someone criticizes Kabbalah, and he's the chief rabbi of his. He didn't dare to publish the book because he understood that's not going to be bought by anyone. So, not that there are not controversies about Kabbalah, but that's a very small literature. Put everything together, even in such a small way. All the anti-Kabbalists, part of it was written in Italy for reasons I cannot imagine. Not only Leon and Reo, but also Italians, some of the Italians, were much more philosophically oriented, they didn't like this form. So a very great part, which is small, but a very great part, were written by people educated in Italy, in Italian entourage, universities, etc. So, but serves them aside. So, this inclusive theology didn't remain such a simple, you know, we have a transcendental God and a revealed God. That is only the very, very modest beginning. It started to develop, how you put it, in a geometrical manner, meaning generation after generation, people added and added and complicated this inclusive, it became so inclusive that in a certain moment we have huge volumes dealing solely with theology, with the divine powers and all the possible aspects of the divine powers that are so complex that I don't understand how someone can remember them. And I'm going to follow some of those developments, this complication of the inclusive theology, which is simply fascinating, that in 350, maximum 400 years, the Jews became huge theologians. And the last form of it in Kabbalah cannot be compared to anything in existence in any theology in the world from the point of view of complication. So complex that is, in my opinion, no parallel by its many details and complexity and the volume of the books written. It's not one small volume which is very complex. Let's think about it. Thousands of folios explaining you detail after detail issues which are simply incredible. I shall give you examples in time, you will see how incredible it can be. So, we have at a certain moment the emergence of a new mode of thinking among the Jews. And in a certain moment, the Jews were capable to become theologians. And not simple theologians, but we're speaking about things which once I wanted to irritate the president of Israel, who was once, if you may remember, here's the head of Israeli aviation, Ezer Weitzman, who knew what is a complex story like an airplane. So I told him, look, an airplane, if you study everything, it's a joke in comparison to reality Kabbalah. Now let's speak about what meaning to be complicated. So, I don't believe that I exaggerated. Meaning that is not for sure I believe that I was very modest. That's a complication, which I shall give you a few examples, but those examples, you know, they are so difficult that I cannot, I must teach a whole year to explain you the complexity of the complexity. But that was, this is incredible, how from a certain moment this inclusivity becomes more and more and more inclusive. And more modes of thought are important. And they are arranged hierarchically and synthetically and parallelly and however you like to put it, whatever strategy you can imagine, fragmentation and further fragmentation and complexity and being together and separating all the time. So here we have another mode, which is, from many points of view, strongly theological. From the other point of view, is strongly ritualistic. From this point of view, the Kabbalists remain very, very faithful to the classical Jewish form of life. And that's why they were not excommunicated. Because they came with a claim about why the Jewish form of life is ideal. So Rabbi would say there's nothing bad about it. If that's your major claim, okay, theology is your problem, I don't care. As long as you don't touch, as Maimonides did, the rituals by this historicizing, by looking at the compromise. As long as you don't do something like that, who can buy your theology? That's not an issue. So, What I should try to do is to give you some main lines into the development of the inclusive theology. And I shall return to exclusive theology from time to time to see that the problem is much more interesting. And Monet didn't disappear because the Kabbalists emerged. But he was for sure diminished. But there are moments in Jewish thinking where Maimonides, out of the blue, became a major figure. When did he become a major figure? I told you already. On the borderline. In Berlin, in the 18th century, when there's someone like Kant, you know, well, that's from Berlin, I know, but that's the entourage. Ah, so we need our Kant is Maimonides. And so on. Maimonides became important, revived all the time, in places of strong Jewish culture, which was in contact with strong non-Jewish culture. So Maimonides was revived time and again. To give you a major example, in Berlin in the late 18th century, an Ashkenazi Jew known as Salomon Maimon. Maimon is not an Ashkenazi name. An Ashkenazi Jew took the name of Maimonides because it was the paragon for him. So, where in Berlin, when he had to discuss with Kant, philosophy. So, then Maimonides is very important. It's, you know, it's Kant before Kant. So, we have Maimonides, another figure in Berlin, the same Isaiah Olemovitz that I mentioned here, he studied in Berlin. Meaning, I believe that's a certain, not a law, but at least that's an affinity between major cultures and the interface, and looking back to Maimonides and reinterpreting him in new terms, just as we reinterpret the Bible in new terms. But those are moments which are very, very rare, that Jews in a very strong creative place became theologians. So we have Levinas, we have. How many do we have? That's few. And they appear all the time in the same borderline, studying with Husserl, studying with Kant, or here and there, and then you need your proof text, which is Maimonides, but the Bible cannot be. They understood very well. So the only alternative was the exclusive theology of Maimonides. So that's the issue that I would like now to pursue with you, to speak about the growth of the inclusive theology, but not to forget that actually it's not the only theology which remained on the surface, but all the time to compare it with what happened to the inclusive theology, which didn't disappear even after the Kabbalists wrote all their books, always there were Jews who attempted to be different. And for them, Maimonides was actually the paragon. He's the example. Okay, so we have a break, and then if you have questions, I don't know.
After the break.
It was something like that, that we learned from Philo. According to Philo, God and rabbi literature, both of them were influenced by earlier views, God has two attributes which can be described as the attributes of justice, which is relatively negative, and of mercy, which is positive. So God is working with two midot, as the name, which are basically described as such, mercy and judgment. In Philo, the two attributes are the royal way, the way God is guiding or supervising or exercising providence on man, and the creative attribute. And they draw from a common source, which we still don't know. Jewish earlier source. So how is this related to the two instincts in man? We have inability to judge, very widespread. I mean, that's an issue which is central for ability base. That man is born with two inner instincts, which are in struggle all the time. I cannot understand otherwise the correspondence. I mean, in God you have a persona with two attributes. In man we have a persona with two instincts. What is the basic common denomination is not the two. It's the formalistic. The basic common denominator is the fact that we don't have two negative visions or two attributes, one positive, one negative. It's not a dualism. It is two ways of divine or human behavior, both of which are necessary in order to have a balanced way, which means that according to the rabbi, what we would call the negative instinct is positive, because without it there is no effort in life, no procreation, no ambition. So there's not an issue that we have a dualism coming from Zoroastrian sources or something like that, that good and bad. Maybe there is some Zoroastrian influences, but that's not the formative story. The formative story is, in order to have a balanced way, we must take into consideration two modes of behavior. And that seems to me to be the very important common denominator of the divine and the human one. It doesn't work simply if you are only merciful. It doesn't work if you are stern. It simply doesn't work. The work, the universe is going to perish, and a person is going to perish. So the idea is not that we have dualism, which is widespread, Gnosticism or Zoroastrianism, but that's something different. That's a very, very moderate dualism, we have to call it. So I believe it's even not dualism. It is the understanding that you need more than one way of behavior in order to balance the other way. So that's the common denominator. That's why I believe that the correspondence between this theology and this anthropology. And from time to time also the human behavior will be called attributes, but that's not the point. Not always an instinct, maybe also without can be used, but that's not the issue. The issue is that we have a conceptual vision which is binary, but not dualistic. And the assumption is that you shouldn't eliminate what you assume that is negative, because that is strictly necessary. Because you are going to perish if someone is going to be all the time merciful and generous. He is going to be unable to create a society. You need some framework, some limitations. So that's why I believe it's not just a Jewish counterpart of dualism. You shouldn't erase one of the two. It's impossible to erase.
What did you say? When you start, what is the difference between God and man, human?
In God is called Midat HaDin, which is the attribute of judgment, and Midat HaRachamim, the attribute of mercy. In man is called Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Ra, which is a good and a bad instinct. So that's not exactly the same terminology. But the Yetzer Ra, which is called bad, shouldn't be suppressed and shouldn't be eliminated. It should be educated. you should be in a way subdued. But you cannot just have a human life guided by only one way of behavior. So that's the common denominator, which in my opinion is very, very important.
Thank you.
Yes.
If we assume this sort of continuity between inclusive theology in rabbinic literature and in Kabbalah, how could we explain then the esoteric dimension?
What I should explain tomorrow, the continuity. I mean, what I said now, I think in general terms, what I said is the inclusive elements in rabbinic theology, which means attributes, angels, feminine power, Shekhinah, glory, Son of Man, all of them are included in the Kabbalistic one. So there is a lot of continuity. But this continuity takes different forms than I'm going to explain. So there's continuity and non-continuity. It's not a simple issue to say that simple continuity, or just innovation, or just using the earlier traditions without respecting them. Meaning, the story is, like many things in life, is complex, and we must see the complexity, and deal with complexities which are difficult, and not subscribe to simple, you know, visions like threads and all these things, obscurant. This obscurant is paid money for translations of philosophy. So, how can you say he was obscurant? When he was the first, maybe in Europe, among the Jews who paid by his money and encouraged translations of philosophy. So that's why it's, for sure it's continuity and discontinuity, etc. But about this issue I'm going to speak tomorrow in details. I'm so clear about those issues. It's incredible. No, I don't mind to speak here. I have no problem if you don't have any other questions. I should continue. We have questions tomorrow. So,
could you explain to me? You wrote three books.
I wrote three books.
So,
what is the force? You are asking me what?
If you have more, let me help, because
yes.
I would really like to read it. Could you give me two words of the three books that you wrote? For example, Mystici and Messianici, and Kabbalized, I think, is the one you will present today.
Yes.
And then the third one is Eros and Kabbalah. Could you give me a...
Well, the summer.
The summer.
So I should give you one. It's not so difficult. In 2 or 3 minutes, maximum I should give you something.
Thank you.
Everything in Kabbalah is complex. In order to understand, you must understand that simple notions should be deconstructed and offer instead a theory of models. So no one has seen the Messiah and no one has seen the Eros. Those are imaginary constructs which, if you don't specify, if you don't define, if you don't qualify, you are creating generalizations which are, by definition, false. So in order to understand, you must start to categorize. That would have been what I did in Messianic Mystics, and what I did in Kabbalah and Eros. So that's a summary. Now, what are those models? That's another stuff. It's another question.
You see, I make publicity of your book, maybe you buy your own.
So you, do you like some percentage? Or?
Yeah.
So, but I summarize the books.
Yeah. Very good.
So, since you don't have half an hour, or,
I have a really big question, but it's also it's also very tangential.
Yes.
So I have no idea whether it's interesting or not.
Yes.
It relates to something that you said, not so much about Judaism, but about Greek philosophy.
About?
Greek philosophy.
Yes.
So I have no idea whether it's interesting.
I don't mind to be wrong about it. You know?
No, no, no.
Greek philosophy is wrong in any case, so I mean, wrong about something is wrong. So, you have a question. I'm learning languages questions. You know? Don't be
basically, you said
shy to correct me. You know? That's the only way I'm learning.
There are a couple of things that you said about Greek philosophy,
yes.
Which one is that the Greek philosophers were not interested in creating a community.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, as you know,
yes.
Plato was very much interested in creating a community.
Yes.
He didn't succeed. But also after Plato,
yes.
Greek philosophy was understood as the foundation for communal life, not only by Epicurus.
So, I see what you read.
You
read Pierre Hadot.
Yeah, exactly. That was the.
I also read him.
Yeah, I know. And the question was, since you also read him, what makes you think that he's not right?
Yes.
That was the question.
Well, I didn't say that Pierre Hadot was right.
Okay.
Pierre Hadot is a French historian of philosophy, still alive, who wrote several very important books. Illuminating books about philosophy as a way of life, not only some form of speculation. To my best knowledge, nowhere in his books he's speaking about community, he's speaking about the way of life of the individual, especially Plotinus. He didn't create a community, and didn't intend to create a community. He was interested basically in one single person named Plotinus. What is important in Hadot is the fact that his observation, which I respect very much and admire, well, it's not Muso, so new, but that's another story. He did it in a very nice manner. Is the fact that he believes that philosophy is not only a mental exercise, but nevertheless, he believed that is a way of life of the individual. I don't say that Hadot would protest against turning this philosophy into a way of life of community, but the community has other rules than the individual. So, with the exception of one philosopher, I know what Plato's attempt to create, and that didn't work, you know, so that's very important why it didn't work. I didn't say that Aristotle wanted to destroy Greece. He didn't want to destroy Greece, but he did. So there was a philosopher who attempted to do it in the beginning, but also didn't work. It was Pythagoras, the only one who really had a group. It was a society, or not, it's not so clear, but let's say he is the exception. This exception didn't continue more than a few years. It happened in his lifetime. So Pythagoras attempted to create a real way of life, which is important for the individual, but was put in service also of a group of Pythagoreans. How long did it survive? So for me, the historical test is very, very important. Not only that Plato is writing, I'm writing the book of Laws. Very nice. But laws were never implemented, are not laws. Or laws were implemented, didn't succeed, they are not laws. So, I'm practical. Show me a society of philosophers. That's the issue. That Hadot contributed another angle of ancient philosophy, I admit, is very interesting. But from my reading of Hadot, and I believe I read a lot of Hadot, I didn't see the community at the center. But philosophy is a way of life, which is true. I believe that Samson is not the first, but it is very interesting the way he put it. And that's really a way of life. And not just knowledge, discovery, and intellection, that's no doubt. But it's very mentalistic, also, at the same time. So, Hadot, I'm speaking about Greek, not about Indians, about others, which is another story. That's my reading from Hadot. If you have, for example, I'm wrong, I don't know. So,
yes.
So, but a Pythagorean example I know, but it's how to put it. Let's end this story. Let's say. He rested maybe 20 years, maximum, and then it was destroyed, and it was not recreated. And then it was destroyed more than once, totally destroyed, in many places, in Germany, so the idea is not, you know, the people with intention, you have an utopia. So how many philosophers did write utopies? So very nice, so remaining books, that no one is reading them, and there's no society. So I know philosophers wrote utopies. I know some of the issues, but that doesn't amount to a community. A community for a moment. A community which is lasting for, not forever, but for a while. 100 years, let's say. That's a fair. The rabbis created a community. Survived 1,000 years.
Well, the Epicureans had a community
yes.
which survived for hundreds of years.
Maybe I must read more about Marcus Aurelius.
No, Marcus Aurelius is a totally different kind of thing.
Yes.
No, I didn't mean to
mention. Okay, don't you know the Epicureans? I should try to correct myself. Let's say that you are right.
And also the old philosophical schools functioned in every way like yeshivots.
Yes. No.
Because people flocked to them from all the ancient world and they had to live there.
Yes. Look, the schools I'm acquainted with, Plotinus in Rome, was some people coming from time to time to lectures. They didn't live together too much. They also didn't like each other too much. They didn't have common rituals, because Plotinus didn't believe in rituals. And among themselves, the harmony was not most important. They didn't have a supply, a common cult. Some of them were magicians, some of them were contemplators, some of them were. So, look, the people who came, they were academics. That is the terms they are using, and that exactly what it was. So we are making nice promenades together, very pathetic, and I know that they were also sitting together. I didn't say that they were individuals, each of them another corner of the world. So for sure, there are schools. I didn't say there are not philosophical schools. Schools is not a community. A community for me are people who have totally different interests, and they have nevertheless, common denominators. Philosophers are people who like for a while to study here, then they're going elsewhere. Like Plotinus, who came from Egypt, to here and there, wanted to leave to war for a while, came to Rome, meaning not a very stable life. But there's nothing like, they are admirers, they are disciples. But that's not a community. Means that people who are eager to learn together and they are coming to lectures, taking notes, and discussing from time to time, not too much. For example, I don't know of any discussions similar to the Talmud. For example, the Talmud is an example of a community. People are arguing, and the argument is found together, and you know who said what to whom. You know any discussion between two students of Plotinus? Each of them wrote his book. The books are not so similar. He don't call the other as images. That word is not a problem, but that you don't see the community active in the written books. So that's why Plotinus didn't intend to have a community. You want to escape. To escape to, you know, to the no one. This, the one to one, that's why very important. What is Neoplatonism? One going to one. So that was the community. It doesn't matter how many books are going to write. Someone who believes that he can summarize things one going to do one. You know, the other way. Even this one is God, doesn't it? So let my mother know about the Epicureans. I should study them, maybe you're right. So I'm ready to make an exception. I never heard about people living together. Let's just survive for a long period of time. Let's do it. The school. What were the schools? No, Kantians are still alive. The school, but they are living together. Aristotle living as a Kantian, or a Neoptolemy's or a Kantian. No, I'm the Siskerian. They are disciples of a certain way of thinking. And that is for me another story. That is scholastic. It is not community. Community is when you believe that the other one, who is stupid or wrong, is nevertheless part of your social body. You don't exclude him. If you're excluding all the stupid people, you're not going to have a community. The philosophers were not so eager, you know, to live with stupid people. And that's one criterion at least.
Could you say the same about, for example, Confucius in China, or maybe Buddha?
Yeah. Or look, one, I don't claim to have universal truth. What I spoke was about philosophers, Greek philosophers, or Western philosophers, which I admit has also important elements of way of life. Confucius or the Hindu have not only a way of life, but also communal life, which can be conceived according to their self-understanding as philosophical. But my claim was not that Jews were the only community in the world. What my claim is, what we compare the two major vectors in the Western civilization, that what we have. If you are going to show me a community of Confucians, that's very nice, that's no problem. So, you know, Chinese were also very social. They are still very social. They don't disintegrate like Russia, I don't know what. That's also philosophy. Maybe a very deep philosophy. People living together, it's not a philosophy. It's not to come to a session and people are telling you, look, listen to this code. Go. And after 5 years, you come back and you understand. That's what you mean. That's an instruction. That's a way of life. But maybe there were also communities. I don't exclude, and that was not what I said. I spoke about the Greeks. I can be wrong or right about the Greeks, or about the medieval thinkers. I don't know the community created even by theologians, like Alexander Augustine. There were others, which is another story, others which accepted certain forms of theology. But that's not exactly the philosophy. So, in any case, remember, I'm not always right. I'm right in the vast majority, I'm saying that it's more than enough.
Thank you.
You say that community and society are the same thing.
Look, there are many societies without community. America is a big society without community. It's small communities, which are not exactly that Amish, and there are some Orthodox in New York, which are strong communities. Ask them how American they are. If they really are Americans, they are part of American society. So you see what answer they are going to give, you know. So the Americans are wise enough to allow them. They are not part of our society or a group. We give you some exceptions. And these are Kiyatovel, the Orthodox, Philadelphia, those guys, you know, they don't bother us. It's not a community. It's a community for sure. For sure not a philanthropist. For sure not a philanthropist. Doesn't matter how you define. So there are societies without communities and communities without societies.
Did you say that the population living, for example, on the top of a mountain, let's say 15,000 people, having the same religion, the same sort of life, the same rules,
it
would be a community?
Yes. Doesn't matter. Total. Doesn't matter.
No, but
it's not society. Okay, it does. The community without the society. Okay. That's, you know, if I'm, how to put it, allowed to teach something to the European market today, which is very easy to teach today, the European market. Here in Europe, people scarcely learn how to buy, how to build a state. They built the super state. They didn't learn how to build the moon. So look what happened here. As well as everything is working fine, there was more crisis. It's our business. If you're Greeks, tomorrow is done, you're not Italians. First crisis you have, exclusive. Is that the community? No, that is something different. In the community is one new for good or for bad. Believe that that's part of your responsibility. So you care for, not to say that it's very nice to have you here, but in the moment you make us more problems, simply leave us alone. So that's, you know, that's the secret that Europe didn't learn. How? Because the Greek philosophy. We are building big stories, states, on the micro, no problem. That's why minorities have their problems. So, I finish my lesson. Okay.
Yes, the last question.
Okay.
I wanted to ask, in the morning, you spoke about this community, and you spoke that it should be very performative.
Yes.
And in the way of doing things.
In the way of?
Doing, to do.
Yes.
But in the practice, when you are measuring something in the way of doing, is not can be. It's difficult to measure something in doing because you can do also wrong thing.
Look, my issue is not to measure. You know, I observe. There's an ethnograph or that anthropologist. If someone comes from outside, he cannot see the philosophical process. There's an inner process. He can see the performance. If this process can be measured or not quantitatively, I believe that yes. But that I don't believe that we have a real criterion on how much is good and how much is bad. But you can see an organization which is working together by synchronization. How much is it synchronized? Not just doing whatever, you know, in a certain place. And that is performed. No, we're speaking about a ritual done in a very specific manner, in a specific time, by many people, over hundreds of years. That is performance. So I didn't say that performance is good or bad, contemplation is good or bad, but that's something which can be seen. It's conceived by the people during the essential. How to measure? For sure it's a problem how to measure. There are societies or Jewish societies or communities in which everything is very short. You can ask how important it is, the marginal, less marginal. For sure there are problems. But speaking about most of the Jewish communities over hundreds of years, you can say something about it. For sure you can bring me a variety of to put it, different synagogues, which are so different from each other. They know. Well, the prayers, in a way or another, are synchronized, less synchronized. When speaking about synchronized, I have many, many critiques of system, but I cannot enter it. But what I don't measure, I don't say that's good, but I'm saying it is, that is a mark you can see from outside that's repeating itself for a long period of time in many, many different places. There are differences, for sure. There were Kabbalists praying for half a day, and there were Jews praying for half an hour. So this is not exactly the same. But both of them believe that the prayer is important and do it vocally together in a certain place. So that's a minimum of what can be called a complex constant. For sure, it's not a constant which is the same, but it's constant nevertheless. And look, don't put evidence on what I'm saying. I don't say that good, I don't say that bad. What I'm saying is that is a way of life which differs from a Greek way of life, which survived, and I don't understand why it survived. Why the great Greek minds in Greek society, why Greece disappeared, not today? Then, you know, this great culture. So, what remains? Aristotle. That's very nice. But Greeks today cannot read Aristotle. Their language is different. That's another universe. So, take a small child at the age of 4 or 5 in Jerusalem, in wisdom, religious education, you'll see that he can read ancient texts at the age of 4 or 5. So there is something in common denominator. Why don't the Greek read ancient Greek? Maybe you're reading better here than Greeks. Why? Because it's the community. It's a culture which is very important. In the ancient time, it's very nice to claim that you are the descendant of Aristotle, but you have nothing in common. Some part of the language. So, I don't diminish Aristotle, but that's a way to look to it, which is just one of the ways. Maybe there are other ways. In the last one, is it there? Yes. So, tomorrow. There is something new. What is new? The idea that there are 10 divine powers, which is also not totally new, but basically no one discussed in such an elaborate way. But the importance from rabbinic literature, a variety of small mythologies, and put them into the scheme of the Tensura. That's why it is inclusive. So, first, the idea that there are 10 powers named Sephirot is not new with the Kabbalists. It's found in a small book named Sefer Yetzirah. No one knows when it was written. People are divided, scholars are divided between the 2nd century or maybe earlier, and between 6th, 7th century after the Arabic culture emerged. So that's a gap between different datations of scholars. This book is not a Kabbalistic book, despite the fact that Kabbalists are treating it as such. That's a book on cosmogony, very short book, some 2.5-3 pages. And there, the idea that there are 10 powers, doesn't sound divine, but I'm not so clear, cosmic for sure, is found. And the Kabbalists took it from there, there's no doubt. However, the Kabbalists combine this view with the idea of the infinite, or the Ein Sof, or the transcendental God, which is higher than the 10 divine powers. So, the very idea of the 10, that's totally new with Kabbalists. There are a lot of rabbinic discussions that God created the world by means of 10 speeches or utterances. But the Kabbalists took the idea of the 10 and transformed it into the frame for interpretation of all the other wishes. which are binary or trinitarian or whatever. And that's what I would. What is new, my point of view, what I can do now, is this issue. That how they can organize the earlier rabbinic small discussions on deity. That is the strategy used by the Kabbalists. So, 10 spherot, which means 10 numbers originally, but the numbers were interpreted cosmically, in a way reminiscent of Pythagoras. It may be that it's a Pythagorean influence here. In parenthesis, what I'm telling you, that's why in the Renaissance people believed that Pythagoras was a Kabbalist, and he learned from the Kabbalists. Because the Sefer Yetzirah was attributed to Abraham. So Pythagoras became, in a way, a Kabbalist. And that's a long scene in the Renaissance, because of this idea of Sefirot, which are numbers. But it is quite plausible that Pythagorean ideas found the Neoplatonists or middle Platonists influenced Sefer Yetzirah and the entire Kabbalah. However, for the Kabbalists, the idea of the number became less important than in Sefer Yetzirah. And for the Kabbalists, the Sefirot are divine attributes, but better to say divine powers. So divine powers means that God is creating, exercising providence, ruling the world by means of those 10 Sefirot. That's which are, in a way, instruments of the divine, but also are the divine themselves. So the Kabbalists were not always so precise about this issue. They are just instruments, or they are God himself in 10 different manifestations. So what is interesting, and that seems to be new with the Kabbalists for the time being, is that there is a differentiation of the features of the characteristics of each of the 10 spheres. They are not just 10 numbers, 1, 10, having the characteristic of numbers alone, but they have other characteristics which are hypostatic, meaning they are not just numbers, they are entities standing somewhere in themselves, not existing separately, not abstractions of our mind. They are objective divine powers and not what we see as categories of understanding reality. So God used now not two powers, like the two attributes they mentioned yesterday, but now 10. But they are calling them by the same term used in rabbinic literature, midot, which means divine attributes. So here we have the rabbinic term, midot, which was found earlier, thousands of times, but attributed now to 10 Sefirot, that are called also midot. And now the idea is, what characteristic, what is the logic of the structure of the Sefirot or the characteristic of the Sefirot? So, there are several types of different logics which are found there. The first three are organized in an order, the first order of noetic activity. That I'm starting with the second and third, and then I shall return to the first. The second and the third sefira are wisdom, chokma, and bina, understanding. Regularly, in the places we're going to look at the sefira, the first one is called keter or crown. It doesn't work with the other understanding. But it seems to me that the original triad, the three first spheres, was thought, the first sphere, Machshava, wisdom, yes. And it's found in Kabbalistic literature, but in a way that they have the crown to cover. But I believe that a certain important logic was the logic of the inner human soul. That is the first manifestation in someone who likes to do something. In most of the cases, it's intimate. It's
emphasizing his inner qualities. And that's why thought, wisdom, and understanding are, I think, the original structure of the first three. And then there are seven others, which are manifestations which are more visible from outside. As if someone is thinking and then starting to do. So this is one of the logics. Means divine activity starts with the inner thought and progressing and manifesting itself in an external manner, from the inner to the outer. So that's why the other spherot, number four, which is mercy, that you do something, someone else. Or the fifth sphera, Gibura, which means strength or power or judgment, they are manifestations outside. They are relations much more than inner processes. And so on. I would like not to enter now, sphera, but that is one of the logics. Three mental operations, seven external operations, which makes sense from the point of view of the idea of the divine manifestation. God is manifesting himself by the means of the Spirit. So he is manifesting himself slowly by thinking what to do and then starting to do. And that is part of the process of creation. God created by means of the Spirit the world. That is one of the logics which I believe can be understood easily. A totally different logic found in the system of the Ten Sefirot from the very beginning is the anthropomorphic one. And all the Sefirot were designated as anthropos, or men, or Adam. Adam Elyon, Adam Kadmon, the supernal man, or the primordial. It's a totally different logic. It's a totally different symbol. The idea is that God is manifesting himself by links of a divine body. So this is very reminiscent of the Bible, of the image of man, the image of God, God the image of man. So that is a very strong, different logic than the logic I mentioned earlier, in which the shape is the most important manifestation. So each of the ten spheres were attributed to certain limb, starting from the head and to eyes and so on, up to the last figure that I'm going to mention in a moment. So that's a logic very, very different from earlier one, and maybe even incompatible, but in any case, it's substantially different. That's another example of how, by means of ten, you import earlier material, and you explain by means of ten, which are more empty categories, by putting meanings, symbols, if you like to call it so, I should speak later about it. In this anthropomorphic logic, the Kabbalists absorbed the feminine element in the divinity, found earlier, in a minor manner, I like to say, in a minor manner, in Rabbi Yisrael. Not only a male structure, but if you remember the Bible, in the image of male and female, so the Kabbalists took it very seriously. So you cannot have only a male on high, so it must be also a female. But the Kabbalists emphasized very much this feminine aspect of the last divine power of Sphira. That became one of the, how to put it, most important or influential traditions of Kabbalah, meaning the feminine aspect of divinity as positive, having a positive role, and strictly necessary in order to have a balanced reality. But it has nothing to do with creation as we think, that's a totally different logic of the perfection of the divinity by including male and female at the same time. Now, here the Kabbalists were very, great extent, radical. Earlier I spoke about the much of conservative aspect of the Kabbalists attempting to bring in earthly material, but there are moments in which the Kabbalists may be worthy. So let me attempt to discuss this issue, which is very, very important today in scholarship. So, was the God a singular or exclusive, as the philosopher would say, or was he having the family? So the answer from the Bible is apparently simple. God was for sure not married, nothing there around, apparently. It's one of these real conflicts. The Bible, I must say, is a little bit more complex than this statement, which is very widespread. God is single. The one. In the biblical period, there are some inscriptions found in Sinai, in which is written God, the Tetragrammaton, and his Asherah, Asherato, meaning Asherah is the name of a goddess. God was married. That's found in two different inscriptions, which are not part of the Bible, but are part of the background of the Bible. That's written in Hebrew, found in China, not far away from the place, the center of Israelite religion. And that became a major issue in scholarship of the Bible. And there are many books written about this one inscription. If you took those two inscriptions together with Genesis 1:26, male and female, in his image, became a little bit more like sense. But in fact, the situation is even more complex. If we look now to what is written in the prophets and not in the temple, we see a very strong metaphor of the people of Israel as the wife of God. God is catholically married to the people of Israel, and they are playing the role of the missing female. First chapter of Hosea, you can see Peter's adulteress, God had a lot of complaints against the people of Israel, as if they were unfaithful, an unfaithful wife. It's a strong power in the prophetic theology, not in the Pentateuch. This marriage, which is an alliance, having a very strong sexual component. First chapter of Hosea makes it very, very, very strong. So it's not so simple that God in the Bible is, a monotheistic figure, independent, has no family relationship, no sexual relationship. That becomes, at least metaphorically speaking, the way the Bible is expressing itself by metaphors, it's for sure not. I mention it because after the Bible, a certain new theological term emerged, which is known as Shekhinah, which is in Hebrew feminine, which means basically the divine presence in this world. And scholars of rabbinics make huge efforts to say that's meaningless that term is feminine. It just happens, it's feminine, but doesn't have any female significance. And maybe it's true in many cases in our tradition. Nevertheless, I believe that already in our tradition we have some form of strong feminine sexual, which is rare, but it's found. And those characteristics reflect much earlier vision, much earlier, by 2 or 3 millennia before our tradition. If you want to check dictionaries of Assyrian languages and Akkadian languages, you're going to see that Shekhintu, which is again female,
system is the governance of a city. Meaning the power governing here. But it cannot be a coincidence that we have a feminine new term in Rabbinic literature, which is feminine, and this is brand new, you know, without any background. Well, we can see the background in two cultures close to the earth. So given the fact that there she is very feminine, not by grammatical gender, but by her role as a governess of a city. That is the way that also the rabbinic discussions in some cases describe the Shekhinah as found in the temple. She is the governess of the temple in Jerusalem, just as Shekhinah is the governess of other cities in Assyria. Which means the background of the rabbinic Shekhinah is a feminine, clearly feminine figure, a hypostatical one, taking care of what's going on in a certain area or temple or city. So, if such a reading is true, the Kabbalists actually didn't innovate too much. They took a term which was loaded, at least in some cases, with strong feminine characteristics and included it into an anthropomorphic scheme, like in the Bible, Tzedek, which combines male and female, and they presented something which is maybe new, but it's not totally revolutionary in comparison to earlier traditions that we have. However, here that's not the radical part that I mentioned. The radical part was that the perfection of the 10 divine powers or structure is based on the sexual union between the male and female part of the divinity. And that is depending on the human behavior. So that is the radical part of Kabbalah, which we can be a good find. That's one. That in fact, human activity is conditioning what happened in the divinity from the point of view of the sexual union of divine powers. We'll speak about this obsession more in other contexts, but first think about the Ten Sefirot. The Ten Sefirot are not just static powers, independent, divine, only governing us. They are also depending on us. That's a correlational type of theology. The Sefirot are the sources, but they are at the same time influenced by us. And a major influence is related to this anthropomorphic imagery of male and female. So, in a certain moment, we have, in fact, a religion in which the commandments are, in fact, a tool for influencing the divinity. Not just a way to obey the commandments of God, but also a way to influence God. But that is not totally new also in Rabbinic literature, but the Kabbalists pushed it to the forefront. That became a major issue in Kabbalah. We have the same Ten Sefirot, but they're interpreted now in a more dynamic way, more correlational. We depend on them, they depend on us. It's meaningless to speak about the theological structure, and here's the element I would like to emphasize, as totally independent, transcendental, creative, and then we are left. But on the contrary, this system is still exercising its influence and is suffering our impact, for good or for bad. So here the Kabbalah plugged in on a need of offering what can be called the rational of the commandments. So here we arrive to the question, why? The Kabbalists answer their answer, the question was. My mother's answer was, why? It's a compromise. You know, for a while, commandments were important, like sacrifices, but now they're obsolete. Prayer, why? Because everyone is praying. We need emotional need to speak to God, so we are praying. That's the why of Maimonides. Very, very historical. Transforming the commandments into Hegelian development. It was a time they are going to become obsolete. More and more and more. More mental we become, less important the commandments. God is so mental that he cannot take care of it, so we need them to educate us. That's education, no really deep, profound significance, historical compromises. Now come the Kabbalists and say, what do you think about it? Those ways of behaving are quintessentially necessary for God, not only for us. God needs. And that became the major answer of the Kabbalists to the philosophers. According to such an answer, there's no way to speak about historical development. God needed sacrifices. And here we have a poem, a very interesting poem, used by the Kabbalists against Maimonides. So, in Hebrew, sacrifice is called korban. In Hebrew, we don't know exactly why it's called korban. There's the term lakri used to sacrifice. The Kabbalist came with a very nice theological explanation. Korban means, it's related to the root, the karev, to bring close to each other. And then they are saying, korban means to bring close the divine powers to each other. So what Maimonides is saying, that's something passé. Kabbalists are saying, no, that is something, a need to bring the divine powers together, that is atemporal, it's not an historical story. So that seems to me to be very important. The Kabbalists offer a theology which is inclusive, but the most inclusive part of it, that this theology offers the rationals for the commandments. I mean, that's why the Kabbalists, unlike Maimonides, were not criticized. Because the rabbinic elite was very happy to have such a strong new interpretation of the commandments in a significant manner which offers an alternative to Maimonides' rationalistic, historically, how to put it, based solution. So when I'm speaking about theology, I don't speak only about theology separate from the ritual. From this moment, we have the ritual as playing a major part in shaping the theology. From this point of view, the Kabbalists neutralize the fact. The influence of Maimonides' interpretation of the commandments, which became a major problem for the Kabbalists. So, one of the major ways is to speak about the union of male and female as quintessential for the divine perfection and depending dramatically on human nature. So that is a theology, but it's a theology based on interaction, not about just knowing the structure of God. For my moment is to know, if you can know at all, the divinity is a mental operation, nothing more. No action can help you. For the Kabbalists, they would say, what we are doing, all the commandments are intended basically to influence or to perfect or to complete the divinity. So, that is also part of the inclusive part, inclusive Kabbalistic drive.
you don't include only elements of theology, you include also the elements of religion. That is a major, major contribution. You don't understand how major it is. When I spoke about the what and the how, it's not an accident that the Bible of the rabbis did not offer rational commandments. It's an accident that such huge literature dealing with commandments did not speak about rational. It was forbidden to speak about it. We have very clear statement in the big literature against offering rational to commandments. Present that. Because the assumption is, you start to speak about the reasons why you do, you don't do. Yeah, I know the reason. Interesting enough. So rabbis interdicted discussing at all the purpose, the rational of the commandments. We have clear statements in them. That's why we don't have discussions, and for sure we don't have a genre of people explaining commandment after commandment, what is the rational. And the whole rabbinic literature, including rabbinic literature written in the Middle Ages or today, no great figure is going to tell you why do you perform the commandments. You perform them because you must perform. That's all. What is new with the Kabbalists? They created a new genre, which to a certain extent is a reaction to Maimonides. Maimonides didn't write. He wrote a book about commandments, but not about the rational of the commandments. But I told you here there are two or three small observations in all these books. The Kabbalists decided to write books about rationals of commandments. So it was big books, hundreds of pages, not two or three pages. And that is part of what I call inclusive theology. Theology in itself is meaningless. If you don't do something in this context, you don't have God. You are just, you know, learning something. And that's the way in which Kabbalah is interpreted even today. You know the name of the 10th philosopher, you know Kabbalah. Which the Kabbalists will love. They tell you, that is as if you know the alphabet that you cannot read. You know the alphabet, so what? So the reading is to apply the structure of the 10th philosopher to what you do. If you don't do it, you are not an alphabet, but you are unable actually to use the knowledge. To use the knowledge is not to know. For sure you must. To use your knowledge is to act. And the inclusive theology is offering rationals for your activities. And that is a certain form of empowerment. I mean, when I do something, it's not just obedience. It's not just nostalgia of my grandfather's needs, or my psychological needs, or a social affair. You go to the synagogue in a certain moment together, it was nice to meet you. That's something for the Kabbalists, in addition to all those which are considered to be minor issues. That is a way not to serve God in the way, the West is to serve or worship. That is a way to make God. That's a strong statement, but that's not my statement. The Kabbalists are using it very strongly. Is to make God. We are making God. Because otherwise, for a variety of reasons I cannot enter now, which is discussed later, God is going to disintegrate. That's correlation. We don't do our part, God is going to retreat. So, when I speak now about the 10th Sefirot, it's not just a matter of a map of the divine. So you know this map, and it's very nice, you know. That will be a gnosis. What happens with the Kabbalists? They wanted an applied gnosis, or a gnosis for life, not for escape from life. So here we have the 10th Sefirot serving much more than mapping divine powers, but making sense of each of the commandments, each commandment put in relation to a certain sphera, or to a couple of spheres, or to more than two spheres. And that became a very complex story. Meaning, when someone is performing the commandments, he must intend or direct or channel his attention to the powers related to what he's doing. So actually, that is a strong interpretation of this. You don't just do and think about what you're doing in general terms. You must have a very specific knowledge and a concentrated form of activity which is related to a specific realm within divinity. Otherwise, that work cannot say, I do it, and God knows. No, you must know, and you must concentrate on what you are doing in a very, very specialized manner. Not certain spirit in general, certain spirit, two spirit, to perform there some form of what they call unification. So, that is the meaning of the inclusive. Inclusive is including, knowing, and doing together. So, such a reading of the early Kabbalah, and that appears, in my opinion, in all the first documents of Kabbalah, from the very beginning. That's like the DNA of Kabbalah. The theology of Ten, and the relationship between commandments and the divine powers. Those two elements, when they are together, I call it the document of Kabbalah. If they are not together, that becomes a problem. Because later Kabbalah elaborated on those issues more and more and more and more, and that became the core of Kabbalah. As I told you, 10 divine powers you can find earlier. You can find earlier some form of activity exercised on God, but we saw it in sphere. But the convergence of the two, of a certain theology, with a certain understanding of the ritual, that created, in fact, Kabbalah. That gave an impetus for speculations. What are exactly those ten spheres? And how are we related to them? That was a brand new area, which created immediately literary genres. On ten spheres, we have something like 200 books dedicated solely to this issue. We have millions of discussions. But as a genre, we have 200 books on the sphere to understand. You know, this novelty is so strong that people have to explain to themselves and to the others again and again. On the commandments, we have tens of books, but on the commandments, each one, each book is hundreds of pages. So, in a certain moment, the novelty of Kabbalah is introducing not only ideas, but also literary genres. It can be checked. We don't have those literary genres before. So that's why Kabbalah starts in a certain moment. We have documents in which this affinity between theology and commandments is quintessential. So that has to do a lot with the body image of God. The trouble is, after Maimonides, who will tell you God is a body? Because Maimonides declared as one of the principles of Judaism that God doesn't have body. So the Kabbalah would say, for sure, doesn't have body. That's the structure. We try to call it light or fire or everyone speculates in different ways. For sure, it's limbs, but not limbs of flesh. Limbs! So, they were a little bit dark about it. They didn't speak about crude anthropomorphism, but they used all the anthropomorphic images they could find. But when asked, so what do you speak about? That does he have a body? No. But they are using the body. So here we enter a moment of ambiguity. My body, this is right. But he's also wrong. Is he saying that God cannot be described in anthropomorphic terms? For sure, it's not true. That's in the Bible. But is the Bible anthropomorphic in a simple way? No, for sure. So they enter here a certain form of ambivalence, ambiguity, double speech, which demonstrate the place they were between the traditions and between the memories. And they were oscillating all the time between the camps. Depends who were asking them the question. So in such ambiguous situations, they were able to create a vast literature. And what is fascinating, a literature was created by first elite Jewish peoples. That is very, very important. Not all the documents of the Kabbalists are written by the first elite, but many of them, I would say, a nice part. So it depends how we limit the time. I think it was 30, 40, 50 years. But in any case, the first Kabbalistic writings don't appear among bizarre people at the margin of the Jewish society. Some of them were the leading rabbis par excellence in the most important center of Jewish culture in the world. The most important center of Jewish power of the world, the leading names, those are no doubt first elite rabbis who offered this form of connection between theology and mind. So from this point of view, that's for sure not a fringe phenomenon. Not accidental. Someone had an idea and okay, it was accepted. No, that came from the elite. Not as an attempt to offer a revolution, but on the contrary, to calm down the situation between the two camps and to recreate some form of modus vivendi, which was disturbed by the Maimonidean revolution. And it is fascinating to see how successful they were. After a while, the Maimonidean controversies calmed down for half a century. And one of this was neither criticized nor accepted. But okay, he is a fact. We cannot eradicate him. But we have our alternative, and that's enough that we are able to create our alternative. And that has to do, as I mentioned, with the 10 spheres which are anthropomorphic and non-anthropomorphic in the center, which could save all the reservoir of images found in the Bible and Arabic literature on the one side, and to save them from an Indian tradition, and not offer a mental vision of religion as feminists. On the other side, their attitude is a little bit more philosophical than traditional people by admitting that it's a high divine power that is, in a way, neo-Platonic. And that's a less crude anthropomorphism than sources, classical sources assume. So that created a possibility to move from one corner to another and stabilize the situation in Provence and then in Spain. And people were in a way appeased by having now the real Judaism, offering a meaning to the commandments, offering some form of acceptable vision of divinity. Neither simplistic nor too sophisticated. And Kabbalah moved on by incorporating more and more and more material found in rabbinic literature and also outside Judaism into this then divine power structure. So that is the, how to put it, the contribution of the inclusive theologies, which I'm speaking now about the simplest first step. The simplest. We're going to discuss issues which are much more complex, but in the beginning it was relatively simple. So 10 spheres, okay, they are 10, but they are one. because they are gods. When are they one? When we perform the commandments. If we don't perform the commandments, they are some form of multiplicity. Or worse, they are disappearing. So, monotheism, yes, depending on us. We don't do our part. God is for it. So here we have a certain, how to put it, ideal monotheism. God is not one. He should become one because of our commitment to unify Him. So here we have monotheism as an ideal, but not as a given. That is a process. And in this process, we are the essential factor. And we would like Him to be one and unified. And that's our task, the basic task, or at least one of the basic tasks. But we cannot just say He is one and wait to see how He is one. He is one when we are going to unify Him. Every minute. It's not just doing it once a year. That must be done daily, and even more than daily. Each prayer, each commandment, everything is intended to the unification of God. That's why, not simply to say the Kabbalists, as the opponents put it, they are politics. They are, and they are not. I mean, it's a complex story. That's what offered to the Kabbalists a certain they could tell the meaning of the Jewish most important way of life. So it was very difficult to dismiss them and to say, oh, you are crazy. So the answer would be, so we tell you, whether you perform commandments. Not the key. Are you just someone obedient? No meaning at all. So here we have a certain strength in the flexibility of the Kabbalistic theological system to absorb also the importance of activity which was central for the earlier phases of Judaism. So that is one set. The first set was mental, external. The second set was anthropomorphic, including the female part, which we are going to detail more. One of ten. Not too much, but we'll see this. There are also a lot of other sets of interpretations of what is the tense, because these Kabbalists came with another idea and added all the time, and that's why we have so many interpretations, because all the time, every several years, a new interpretation of the tense. There are Kabbalists who are describing the tense much more than a Neoplatonic then, like a series of emanations. But even then they are not exactly Neoplatonic. They are prima facies and Neoplatonic, but when you read better, you see that it's not exactly Neoplatonic. Because the Sefirot being divine, the emanations are an inner divine process. They are not an external process, like a Neoplatonic. When the unknown or the one is emanating something, intellect or then the soul, which is not divine more, in a way external. Emanation in Neoplatonism is externalization. For the Sefirot, there is emanation, but emanation within God. God emanated within Himself, created Himself, and the ten divine powers are not outside God, they are inside God. So that's not a new interpretation of Neoplatonism. That is another theory of emanation which existed before. So this is a strong statement, but I cannot enter now in details. Meaning, Neoplatonism and emanation is a late story. Second century, mid-second century, second century. This theory of inner emanation is found in an Hellenistic Jewish text named the Wisdom of Solomon. 250 years before, when God emanated the Chokhmah or the wisdom, it's an inner process. And scholars who edited the Wisdom of Solomon, they are claiming, look, that for the first time we find the concept of emanation. How did the book written 100 years before the Common Era influence Kabbalah? Here, the solution is very, very simple. This book was found in the hands of early Kabbalists. That we know for sure. We have quotations from this book in Syria. That's a long story if you don't know how, but that doesn't matter. It is obvious that the book was quoted verbatim twice by Nachmanides, one of the first Kabbalists. So no one can doubt at all that the theory of inner emanation was known by Jews. I don't say that originally Jewish or not, but at least it was integrated in an ancient Jewish book. And this book was conceived to be very important by major early Kabbalists. They quoting it in Syria. How did you know Syria? That's a nice question, but that doesn't matter. We have the prediction, and it can be checked. It is there. So, we have an interpretation of emanation, but the emanation is not a simple emanation. I know this is a very explorative claim, but it can be more, because that's not the same structure. And the whole story is found much, much, much earlier. You know, that complicates all the history of Kabbalah. Also complicates the history of Neoplatonism. If it is true, and this was my claim, but the scholars who did the thing, you know, the Wisdom of Solomon, they know it, but they don't know by the scholar. And in use, that is the term for emanation long before anything we know of Neoplatonism. Long before. And then, in this case, the problem of transmission doesn't exist. We know how the book arrived, we don't know about this. Historically, small question, the book was quoted verbatim twice. And many Kabbalists are quoting from this book as if they have a bigger book. I don't know if they invented it or... But at least two quotations are from the early history of Kabbalah. So we have another understanding of Sefirot as inner divine emanations. God is creating himself by expanding self within himself, which is not exactly anthropomorphic. It can be totally non-anthropomorphic. It doesn't have to be Pythagorean, despite the fact that 10 is a very important category, Pythagorean number. So I can go on and on to show you that there are whole systems which are imposed on this sphere of all the time, enriching it. None of them turned the earlier interpretations obsolete. All of them was conceived to be, all of them, doesn't matter how much they contradict each other, were conceived to be valid. That's another very important issue. If you remember, the strong incoherence. Now I will tell you, look, but you told me that it's an emanation, and now you are telling me that it's a female power. So how this emanation became a female power? Such a question. It's an interesting question. Is the emanation how it's a number? It's a number, how is the human being? No one asks such questions. Those questions were supposed to be evident. They are at the same time more than one. And that has to do with strong incoherence. People don't care about it. Their assumption is, it's found in that book and that book and that book. All of them are right. We can harmonize a little bit without being bewildered of, you know, of this difference. But no one really sat down to write something systematic about how A link is at the same time also an emanation, at the same time a number, at the same time whatever else. They were not pluralistic, not open-minded. They were traditional, which means what is found in tradition is valid. If you don't know the validity, don't have a system of explanation, there's nothing bad about it. And that this incoherent attitude was very fruitful to enrich all the time the Kabbalistic literature. Because when they learn new systems of thought and metaphysics, for example, they added more majoristic and spherot and so on. And that goes on up to today. You can see books written in English by people in America, great scientists who maybe once would become Nobel Prize, claiming that they understand better than spherot. You know, using their terminology, and I must say, I'm absolutely more than surprised. You know, I cannot convince them not to do something like that because they are so sure that they're writing books, old books, physicians of physics of very high quality. Let's think about the fringe literature. I think about the first elite of scientists in America. And there's no way to convince them not to do it. And they believe that by their new knowledge of cosmology, they make a better sense of this issue. I can give you names. So, that is because incoherence is not important. They look to the sphere, but other parts they don't understand, they don't like, they don't quote. And the traditions. But they immediately add their new insights. And I think books, which are not books of Kabbalah, of science, but, you know, capitalizing on their very superficial knowledge of Kabbalah, I would say. But this enrichment is going on all the time. I think you do a psychoanalysis, they also believe that, you know, you can explain everything, you know, make a psychoanalysis of the divine structure. And so on, meaning everyone is living there. Because the Kabbalists were not so rigorous in creating a system to the close to tell you you cannot add this. In a way, they were ambiguous all the time.
Okay.
So, the Kabbalists being ambiguous and ambivalent allowed a lot of traditions which gave impetus for creating such a good literature. Because after all, if you have a scheme, you explain it once, twice, three times, it's, you can say that then, no, what is going on, that every generation is adding more and more, but what I'm going to discuss in a moment, complicating more and more. When in the beginning, the 10th sphirot, that they drawn only for maybe one generation. Just 10. The second generation, 1230, 1240, in a moment I'm going to speak about the first complication. A deep complication, not adding one sphere or two, but dramatically adding. So, this is the meaning of inclusive, that means that once you include it in the Torah. Inclusive means that they're open-ended inclusive. That is, the system is open to including more and more and more. That I shall try in the next hour to show you how open the system was, despite the fact that it was considered to be traditional and, you know, that's the structure of God, so you know, how do you dare to add the structure of God, new dimensions after everything came? And there was no problem at all. We're going to discuss it. Some minutes, this new, one of the new developments, we're going to speak about many. So in any case, after an hour, I would like to, you know, if there are any small questions,
yeah.
Fine.
This idea of making God, you said it's typical of all the Kabbalah or just of something?
No, it's not all the Kabbalah, but it's found in major parts of the Kabbalah, including most of the classics of Kabbalah, without any problem. For example, it's found in early Kabbalah, it's found in Zohar, found in Uriyan Kabbalah, for the Uriyan Kabbalah, all the major things. For sure, there were Kabbalists who didn't like it at all. I shall speak about other trends. But that is, how to put it, for most of the Kabbalists itself, if you read French, that's a very nice book written in French by a very fine scholar, Charles Mopsy. Lurid qui font
le
700 pages. Lurid qui font the rituals which make God. So, here also I have 700 pages, which is not very. Only about this issue. So that's enough. So for sure we can add more and more and more and more. There's no question about it. But already what he did, he died relatively young. You know, it was just a matter of sitting down and collecting material. I wrote a small chapter or paragraph in my book. And he was very interested in the idea and expanded it to 700 pages. So I am sure that you can write 3,000 pages, no problem. But, you know, only from his book you can see how many pages he didn't book. So that's how to put it, the main line, it's not some bizarre people. Yes?
Touching on what you just said right now, if the theurgic effect can possibly be achieved only through appropriate intention. Does this mean that the observance of the commandments by people who had no knowledge of Kabbalah were ineffective?
So it's a very good question and a very important one. Not only Kabbalists would say that if you are not aware, that doesn't work. Most of the Kabbalists would tell you the rituals work only when you are aware of what you are doing, and you are doing by purpose, because you are doing directing your soul to God. Nevertheless, there are also Kabbalists claiming double. If you do it, it don't work. How it don't work? They don't have an explanation. But they assume that knowledge is not strictly necessary. They won't tell you it's not necessary. But that is a minority vision.
There's a following question. Now, of course I'm wrong, but I frankly can't see how being told by Maimonides that you're idolatrous is worse than being told by Kabbalists that you're an informed observance of the commandments is not going to work.
No, I didn't answer the question.
Yes. Maimonides said, look, you and your forefathers and the whoever wrote that is idolatrous. And this is really bad, right?
Bad for them?
Yes. Okay. Now, a bunch of people come around and they say, look, the commandments work. They're really important. You need their battle, not only for you as an individual, but for God. But only if you perform them with appropriate intention. Otherwise, they're ineffective. Now, if I'm someone who doesn't know Kabbalah, this puts me in a very bad situation as a Jew.
I understand now your question. No.
And
it's what
about all the people in the olden times who didn't know Kabbalah?
The answers are not simple, but they were sensible. First, their assumption is that Kabbalah was not invented by us, not late 12th century. They assumed that Kabbalah was all the time, so all the people were safe. In the past, they were Kabbalists, we didn't know, but they knew, they did it, and they for sure are not in Kabbalah. So from this point of view, the answer was simple, that it was all the time around and no problem. The problem is it was going to
now.
Most of the Kabbalists would say this is an elite story.
Meaning it is intended for them, it's a difficult exercise, which is true. And that's why we keep it esoteric. And the Kavanah or the intention is strictly necessary. And that's why Kabbalah cannot be embellished. Because people cannot make this very difficult exercise. To study all this stuff and to be aware all the time, all the day, that's a very difficult exercise. We're speaking about the simplest forms of it. Now, so some of them refuse to divulge it by claiming, okay, we have the clue, and all the others, sorry, what can we do? We cannot do anything. So they were not worse than Maimonides. They were relatively, how to put it, in a better position by at least defending the commandments.
Okay, but
you are right. There is a problem. Kabbalists were more, how to put it, generous.
Yes, for instance, imagine a situation which that the rabbi was a Kabbalist who believes that only informed observance of the commandment is effective. Yes. And that's his community who is, let's say, let's invent this example, under strong pressure to convert, because otherwise they will be killed or something terrible is going to happen. Yes. Now, he believes that it doesn't make any difference whether his community or all ignorant, simple people observe or do not observe the commandments. Why should they not convert?
First,
this is, of course, a very extreme example.
Look, so very good. The answers were complex. So one answer was esoteric. It's very difficult. We keep it on for the people who are capable to do it. Otherwise, simple people will distort it. For example, the sexual imagery. Better to keep it for the small elite. It's a very strenuous exercise to do. So there were very important trends in Kabbalah which are esoteric. They are conceived themselves to be some form of commander who will be able to. All the others are benefiting, but they cannot contribute in a Kabbalistic manner. There were Kabbalists who were more generous, would say, look, it works much better when you know than if you don't know. Which means the answer was, okay, if they do, it's better than not to do. In a certain moment, we arrive to certain moments, they won't know how to do it. I should give you an example. No. And other people would say, you know, it's working. For sure, God intended it to go to work, and we don't know. We are doing it better, but everyone contributes. Now, to give you the strongest example, the most esoteric among the Kabbalists was the major rabbinic figure, Rachmaninoff. For sure cared for all this, the community and even more. And he had even a stronger idea that commandments can be committed, basically, in the land of Israel. So what do you do in Barcelona? With all the commandments, all your intentions, and everything, you know, it's very nice, but then it's in principle. And it was not necessary to claim something like that, but he claimed it in a very strong manner. So he was wise enough to understand that something ridiculous is going on here. He himself made Aliyah. But not because he made Aliyah, but because, you know, he had a problem with the king and, you know, with the Inquisition, that, you know, at the last moment, so he decided to leave. Otherwise, he would leave. He didn't mean that. But nevertheless, he had an ideology of real commandments are only in the land of Israel. So what does he do? His answer is very simple. We are exercising. What is the meaning? You know, you go to the land of Israel and you start then to learn. You must come prepared, you know, like someone in sport, you know, you exercise for years, for the moment you arrive there. And he arrived there, and that's an explanation. You know, it's convincing or not, that's another story. But here we have someone who's a leader and really caring about it. Don't speak about an individualistic leader at all. And he came with this extreme vision of the land as the Axis Mundi. We are not in the Axis Mundi, we are outside the Axis. So the idea is not, oh, okay, so we wait. We say, I will come, we'll go to the land of Israel, we'll perform the commandments, theologically, or Kabbalistically. No, no, I said, that's not at all, you know. Look to what happens today. All these people having sport are doing it for who knows how many years for 1 minute. So, okay, so it was not so bizarre, if you like. Even in modern times. Yes? So, answers to such a question, there are. There are not simple answers. But what can you do in such a complicated situation when you have someone saying that it's sacrosanct, someone saying that it's historical or obsolete? So you choose something in the middle and create new problems and attempt to solve the problems. And then new problems emerge. And that's what you do when you speak about the land of Israel. And you come to the land of Israel and there's there. The Crusaders are there. And the Mamelukes are there. And the Mongols are there. Oh, it's a sacred land, you know. With all the great powers, you know, fighting there, you are nothing. So that's, you know, that's every answer creates new questions. And he had to deal himself with it. It's not historical, how to put it, exercise. I mean, he arrived in Jerusalem, there's no one in the synagogue. Meaning, the Mongols enter there, erase the Jerusalem. There's no one scroll of Torah in Jerusalem. So we like to perform the commandments in Jerusalem. Nothing. He must bring you a scroll of Torah from Hebron. So that's, you know, so what can I tell you? You know, there's an answer to something like that. There's no answer. So he established the synagogue. On his name, in third city, Sela, still the synagogue on his name, then in Jerusalem, the same place. So you do, you cope with the problem when it emerges. No absolute answer to something like that. And so on. Meaning everyone had his problems and his historical circumstances and had to deal with them on the spot.
Sorry, I was late. I was in here when you started the lesson. Can you tell me, as usual, you can tell me if you can. Tell me the tense below.
Yes.
Can you tell me brief what is their commandment?
No. That's tense below are considered to be the paradigm which explains the meaning of the Ten Commandments.
Thank you. As okay.
So that's, you know, for sure, you know, some of the Kabbalists were great minds, no doubt, the manner in which they combine different layers of literature. And the complexity they had to deal with demonstrated that really they had capacities which are not. But for sure they didn't have absolute answers. They couldn't anticipate the historical circumstances. For sure there are problems which they were not addressed, and for sure I'm not going to address for them. Yes. Okay? So that is the meaning of inclusive. That's the modest form of inclusive. Now, what happened in one generation after the manuscript of Kabbalah? We don't know exactly when, but around 12, 35, 40, the Kabbalist in Gerona comes with the idea that, in fact, how could 10 different spheres interact with themselves? How can they become one if they are different? Each of them has a different characteristic. One is salt, another one is my leg. So, you cannot bring them together. Because that's no organic linkage between them. It's very nice to say that they are one. We have an impact on their unification, but logically speaking, we have a problem. Either they are different, and then they cannot be brought together. Or they are very similar, so the multiplicity is not so important. So he came up with the idea that in each of the 10 spheres, there are other 10. So each sphere has a characteristic of another sphere, and by this characteristic, it can be linked to that sphere and then to the other sphere. So each sphere can be linked to 10 others.
basically the nine atoms, but they are speaking about ten. So in a moment we have how many spheres? 100. So that is already a huge complication.
Why?
Because you, when you link to spherot, you link in fact a certain characteristic of one sphere to a certain characteristic of another sphere, which is not exactly you link two spherot, you link one of the ten aspects of one sphere to one of the ten aspects of another sphere. So you must keep in mind now that this is not just in two spherot, but in the aspects of the sphere. Ten aspect doesn't appear, but later. But the idea of the ten within ten appears relatively early and very clear, which immediately creates another deep complication that you must explain much more than the simple issue of two spheres. So that is the first move in a long move in this direction, which means that around 1540, people ask now how a certain aspect of one sphere is connected to another sphere. They must have also their aspects, which means now we don't know how many spherot are there. Very difficult to calculate even how many spherot. And we have discussions. It's not a statement that you find there. Someone is asking the question. No, no. We're speaking about people dealing with, and I'm quoting with, the aspect of the sphere of Bina, the third sphere, found within the sphere of Keter, the first sphere, found within the sphere of Keter again, is connected to the other, so which is a complication which even I don't know how to calculate how many spheres they had in mind. So that is one major development, which is not just a matter of casuistics. It serves basically a more precise explanation of the meaning of action. We can say, okay, those guys had some sense of complexity and they wanted to have complexity. No, that is not the issue. The issue is that we have a certain problem, inherent problem, in the structure of the Ten Sefirot and 613 commandments. Why do you need 613 commandments if there are only 10 spheres? Or combinations of 10 spheres? 630. So meaning, what happened here, the Kabbalists at that moment wanted to enter a very precise form of explanation. That almost every commandment and every part of a certain commandment has a specific meaning. Which is not to say all the time, this sphere is related to one commandment and again to another commandment. So if so, why two commandments? Why do you need so many commandments to unify the sphere? So there was an impetus related to a need of precision. There are so many commandments and so many preparations for a commandment. For the meaning, there's one commandment called Sukkah. To build a sukkah, but that's a long story. So just one act. So you say that's related to one sphere. It's too simple. That explains to mind. You don't have the details are missing. So they, the real reason for complication is not the theological one, but it's an attempt to offer to each and every aspect of a specific meaning, which is not similar to another commandment or another part of another commandment. So, if we understand in such a way, we can make better sense of their, how to put it, prima facie, you know, fascination with complexity. There is complexity, but this complexity serves them in a very, very clear manner, and they were there in the middle. Or to take another major complication. There's an entire book of the Torah, thousands of words. Well, you have only 10 spheres. So you say again, this guess that's why. Why need God so many words? Speak about Nesirot. He could use 10 words in the Torah. But there are thousands of words in the Torah which are understood as related to Nesirot. So you must enter in this aspect. Ah, this world is related to this sphere, but only to this aspect of the sphere. And the other world is another aspect of the same sphere, and so on. So at a certain moment, there was a strong hermeneutical clue for the entire Bible, which is mathematically precise. And that is the precision when you have so many theological aspects. You choose how to interpret the Bible, but now you are doing it not in a rough manner. Okay, there are 300 words for Malchut for the last year, and 400. So the same question is why. So the answer is very simple: this word is to this aspect, and that word to another aspect or another relationship, and so on. So if we look in such a way, it's not fascination with theology. It's something else. It is the use of the complexity for making a very precise, more and more and more precise reading of the Bible. So in such a way we can understand why we have so many Kabbalistic commentaries on the Bible. And, you know, if you have one, it's fine also. What do you need more? So let's say someone is more substantive. Two, three. But why have hundreds? That's because the theology became more and more and more sophisticated. And every sophistication created a new commentary on the words and a new commentary on the Bible, because it revealed new aspects in the theology. So, if we look in such a way, that is the meaning of inclusive. You create more and more and more and more of the tradition, not, you know, just 10 aspects or some angel or here and there. We're speaking about a project in which the interpretation of the Bible must be mathematically precise, totally differentiated, dealing with a real big process and not just some interlaminations. So that is one line of complication which is simply fascinating. You are going to see how Kabbalists, with the time, create more and more and more aspects. And that's, sometimes you are lost in reading, you must say, what aspect is he speaking about? It's very difficult to keep in mind. So that is only one of the complications. So a line of complication which reaches its peak, maybe in the writings of Moses Cordovero in the 16th century, who introduced the idea of aspect. Earlier, people are thinking about Sefirot within the Sefirot. But the Vero comes with a term named Bechina, Bechinot in Hebrew, which should be translated as an aspect of a facet. So that's a complication which is part of the inclusive. But inclusive meaning, how do you include more and more material from the tradition in this web of interpretation? So what are the problems? What are other ideas about complication? It was not that they rejected this complication, that was nice, but not enough. So there were Kabbalists also relatively early. I don't know how early, maybe from the very beginning. We were not second generation, but for sure it's found in second generation. Let's say in a rather Platonic manner, the spheres we know about, those dynamic spheres, are emanations of a higher realm of spheres, which are similar to the Platonic ideas, which are static, which are found within the infinite. And those static spheres are the paradigm of the dynamic manifested spheres. So we have two sets of spheres at the beginning. Not spheres within spheres, but spheres above the spheres. Which means that we have now a whole story about, when do you speak about the lower sphere, or when do you speak about the higher sphere? Now, here there's a very interesting issue related to the discussion of Maimonides. Those guys will tell us that the great secret is that the higher sphere, or the hidden sphere, are hinted symbolically exactly in the most anthropomorphic part of the Jewish. With the state, there's no Platonic theology, negativa, all this stuff. No, they are saying exactly those. The real secret is not that the Jewish tradition has anthropomorphic terminology, that's obvious. And that's not the solution that the manifested God is anthropomorphic, that's not the whole truth. The real truth is that more anthropomorphic the expression is, it's more plausible that it hints to the inner, highest divine sphere. That's written on obvious. That more anthropomorphic it is there more. Now, that cannot be unrelated to one. And that's a simple way to say, look, our solution about hidden God, a manifested God, is true. But that's not the whole truth. We compromise. You know, we told the people that we have this Neoplatonic God there on high, which is philosophical, okay, well, fine with my words. So some esoteric friends who said that was just cover. The truth is that the real anthropomorphism is not in the manifested sphere, but within the hidden sphere. Which means to tell us that Maimonides did lead the red wrong. And the real meaning of Kabbalah is to find anthropomorphism within the infinite. That is the essential message. Not that we have a combination or not. But in fact, we have a hidden truth, which I don't divulge it because Maimonideans are around and don't want to start again. And no controversy. So we keep for ourselves, in only letters, personal letters, this secret. But that is the secret. The secret is anthropomorphism is dealing with the self originally. The story about the spheroid manifests in such a way, it's also true, but that's not the real story of the God. So, this idea of the 10 supraspheres, or hypersphere, found within the infinity, run from maybe the earliest period, maybe it's not so simple, but from the earliest document, in any case, it's found in the second century. And it arrives up to Colovero, who's saying it again, it's a terrific way, up to Luria, means that not an, how to put it, not a minor idea. But it was kept a little bit under control, because he didn't want to enter again a dispute with the Maimonideans in generation after he passed. So, that's part of the inclusive approach. I mean, the Bible doesn't speak of something secondary. That's the lowest divinity. That's, you know, that was a compromise, our compromise. Really, we believe that this compromise shouldn't be accepted. We should elevate the anthropomorphic part to the highest possible divine sphere as a major secret of God. And with the time, it became more and more widespread. In the moment, we speak about major development, other major development. So that is another strategy, which has nothing to do with philosophy and spherot, despite the fact that it may appear in the same Kabbalistic system, but they are different. And to a certain extent, it doesn't work so easily together, but people didn't feel it. So, let me move to a third strategy found within the Kabbalistic system of Hesperia in late 13th century. We don't know exactly when. The major book of Kabbalah was written, the book of the Zohar, somewhere in this period. Some 20 years ago, we knew exactly who wrote the book, and we were the scholar confident that everything is crystal clear. Since then, we lost our confidence, and more and more and more, we. This idea that Moses de Leon wrote the book of the Zohar, which was universally accepted by scholars, is today at least amazing or surprising for people to know, because we see a lot of problems which are so big that simply doesn't work. I must say that every year we begin more and more and more disappointed with this explanation. And I cannot enter the problems of scholarship, but that's today almost a consensus that we don't have an explanation. We must combine a variety of explanations, many explanations, mostly the only one of the people there, maybe an important one, but for sure not the most important one. For sure not the most important one. Who was the most important one? I have no idea. One of the most important theology in the book of the Zohar, written in history. An important layer, which is not found everywhere in the Zohar theology, which is basically reflecting what I described until now. But the most esoteric, hidden, sublime, profound, whatever you like to call it, is a small literature found in the Zohar books, named the Idra, or the great and the small assembly, meaning a small part of the tradition, but very complex, very difficult, and very, very anthropomorphic. More anthropomorphic than anything in Kabbalah before, and everything later is depending on this small literature, which altogether is nothing more than 100 pages. But that's so obscure and so difficult. It attracted the attention of many, many Kabbalists who are fascinated by it. That is the inner part of Kabbalah, not of the Zohar, of Kabbalah. So, what's going on there? Anthropomorphism is moving more and more to the fore. Very hidden, very difficult, but obvious. Which means that there are a variety of divine anthropomorphic configuration within the sphere, not one, an anthropos. That for sure is true, but that's the simple story. The real story is that we have 4, 5, maybe 6 anthropomorphic structures within the sphere. And each of them has a structure of sphere of itself. So that is a very, very important complication. Not one and the one structure, but 4 to 6. And each of them is not only ten spherot, but a lot of other aspects which are so recondite and difficult to speak about that we cannot but enumerate. To give you an example, it's very, very simple. One of the most fascinating parts of this anthropomorphic structure is the bird of God. Each and every part of this bird has its meaning. So we cannot know how many. there are discussions, you know, which are simply interesting. So here the complication is, in a certain meaning, different from the 10 spheres within the 10 and 10 above. And all this is small money. Here we have relationship, complex relationship between 4 or 5 or 6 divine powers. One is a father, and that's a son, and that's a daughter, and that's I don't speak anymore. And everything in the family story, different versions and different parts, which is different from what I would have seen earlier. Very, very important. for the Kabbalists, not just a complication of someone, but simply considered to be the profound part of Kabbalah until today, the most profound part. Which means that some people in North Africa, Jews who learn those parts by heart, without understanding one word, and reciting it as a prayer. It's not just, you know, a nice part of the, for the Kabbalists. It's a very popular culture. That was conceived to be, I mean, the best part of the ritual. So, here we have a profound story, which is different than what we spoke earlier, and you know, after a break, we shall any your questions, and after him I shall speak about this complication, which is a very, very, very strong. Which is considered to be by all the Kabbalists the most important form of Kabbalistic theology, which is less depending on the Ten Sefirot, but depending on what is called configurations. In Hebrew, parsufim, it's a Greek term for prosophon, for face. But those configurations are conceived to be full-fledged anthropomorphic forms. It's not just the faces. And the term is face itself, but the meaning is full-fledged. So in this system, we have several, four of them. Seven, that's very complex, what I'm going to do here. Very, very gross simplification, because so difficult that every Kabbalist is offering you another interpretation of what's going on there. So the basics are, there is a very high head, conceived to be the most recondite divine configuration, and there is a certain small, high and big face, which is the mercy. And there's a smaller face called Zeyin Adin, which is like the son of the higher God, which will be there in a moment of the son. And there is also a female power, which is comparison to the Malchut or Shekhinah later on. These are the three parts of 4 to 6. There's the three more important. So that's not Trinitarian in the simple sense. But for sure, the idea of the Son and the Father is there. We don't have something like the Holy Spirit in the system, but it's quite obvious the discussions of the Father and Son is there. So that's inclusive of a much older Jewish tradition about the Son of God, which is not recognized as such in scholarship, not to speak of the Kabbalists. So, I'm not offering a Christian reading of Kabbalah at all. But I'm telling you that is a development which I can document, and I wrote a huge book, 700, 800 pages about it, trying to document the Christian improvisation now. The inclusiveness is the inclusiveness of another early rabbinic and pre-rabbinic idea within the Kabbalistic system. Which means that if you're going to read some verses in the Bible, used a lot by Christian theologians, you're going to see that God is saying, my son, today I gave birth to you. That's written in the Psalms. And it's written B'ni Atah, that's in plain Hebrew. For sure there are Jewish commentators saying that the people of Israel is not a persona. That's true. That's a major Jewish interpretation. However, in the context, it's not so simple because that's the king. And the whole idea is related, in my opinion, to the king as the son of God. So this was a major issue. in ancient biblical Buddhism, which means that not only in the Bible, in Mesopotamian and in Egyptian theology, that the king is the son of God. But from this point of view, the Bible doesn't offer anything special. But the idea is that the king is not immortal. But in a way or another, he is the son of God. He is the son, either by being adopted when he became king. Then he became the son of God, like in Mesopotamia. Or he was born out of God, like in Egypt, from the very beginning. So that's the question about what's going on in the Bible, oscillating between Mesopotamia and Egypt. That's a too complex story, because that's hard to decide. But it's not an exception, not a biblical creation. But it's something that the most important person is representing God. And the king is representative of God that runs from ancient Egypt up to medieval period in Europe, when the king was considered to be God. The great majesty and all this stuff is inside of God, not inside the king. So, such a vision is found in the Bible. One of the many visions. I don't say that's the major vision of the Bible, but as far as the king is concerned, it is found in the Psalms. Maybe in more than one place. So the rabbis took it over without any problem. But in the moment Christianity became more prominent, it was marginalized. However, the tradition survived. Marginalized or not, they were around. In the Middle Ages, I found texts, in my opinion, very strong texts, in which this idea of sonship of important figures is simple. I mean, that's, no one felt, how to put it, afraid to put it in explicit terms, in a way that cannot be misunderstood, so it's cannot be misunderstood. So the Kabbalists adopted also this form of theology in one of their theologies. That's why it's inclusive. Whatever they could include, they included. So they included also this theology that in fact there is a father-son relationship. Without incarnation or without the idea of messianic figure, this son with no divinity is not a messianic figure for them. And maybe it's even anti-Christian, because the smaller son figure is considered to be relatively negative in comparison to the father, which is running against the idea of Jesus and love. So it's not a simple issue to speak about Christian or non-Christian influences. It's very complex. It's ancient Jewish texts, brought within, maybe against Christianity, maybe not. But that I'm less concerned with this issue. Now what is important is here we can see again the inclusive aspect of the Kabbalistic theology. That's why later, late 15th and 16th century, when the Kabbalah and the Christian milieus, it was recognized immediately that is the Christ. In Kabbalah, here in the Hidra, we have the idea of Zerantim, which is the Christ. And you can see many, many diagrams. How obvious it becomes for Christian theologians that here we have finally a proof that the Jews had such a vision in their thought. The problem is that there are any Jewish texts not written in Jesus Christ. Some, that is not exactly the same. But for Christians, it was enough to have the idea of sonship. So that's another long story, which is running up to 20th century Christian esoterics. You're going to read books of Alistair Crowley, for example, and Eliphas Levi, and a lot of occultists. You're going to see, Zerantwin, that is, you know, that's Christ. Obviously it's Christ. Put in diagram, very, very clear.
But it became a major form of, maybe the most influential part of Kabbalistic theology, is not the ten sphere, but the much more anthropomorphic part, which was translated immediately into a variety of languages, Latin and then European languages, and became one of the bases of Madame Blavatsky's theosophy. Her theosophy is based on the Ida, on this part. Again and again, she is speaking about those issues a lot. So here we have another theology, inclusive, even elements which you wouldn't suspect, but offering intellectual alternatives to Kabbalists. You have this form of worship of a sun, but it's not automatically a Christian story, as for sure Christian theologians have claimed. When you look to the details, you see that it's much more complex, maybe even anti-Christian. Now let me move to one more complication. In the system of the four, of the ten, you have also a sister of four, which is different to the anthropomorphic one, which I call the Holy Family. But a family of four, and not three, composed on two couples, Hoffman, Bina, mother and father, or father and mother, and different Amarhu, the last Sfirot, his son and daughter. That became widespread there, meaning I believe there are at least hundreds of discussions about this issue, which is capitalizing on the sexual issue, but complicating it by having two couples on hand. And according to some Kabbalists, who knows how many couples, sphirot within the sphirot, because that is only the beginning, but those couples are found also within each sphira. So you can imagine immediately how many couples there are around, you don't know. Up to the highest sphere, it also comes. It's very, very important, because that created the centrality of the two sexualized polarity. Everything is within. What you see today, you know, in Freud and Jung, all this stuff is influenced by this. This couple is not only an inner device, though. It's not just two spirit or here and there. They are found within all the spirits, within reality, within the human couple. Everyone is male or female. Doesn't matter. Male is a female part, that's Jung copied this spirit. Simple. Not only, but for sure also, including the idea of the four, which is Jungian and not Freudian, the idea of the four is also found. So those are examples of inclusive theologies, which are only some few examples. I'm going to speak about much more of it, in which you can see how the Kabbalist felt free because of the idea of incoherence. Because you cannot bring together all those theologies. That's impossible. Doesn't matter how sophisticated you are, to operate with all those systems at the same time in an harmonic way is simply impossible. And I don't believe that they intended to do it. They made efforts, modest efforts, to bring them together. But they were not worried about the problems. And the problem didn't deserve them. Say, either or. So I prefer one or the other. They would prefer one or the other, but not saying that the other is not correct, or we have a logical problem with it, but that was a certain selection made by the Kabbalists for their purpose, because they were interested more in one aspect than the other. But for example, this principle of male and female, that's widely accepted. Not everyone, but can speak about major Kabbalists speaking explicitly about in male we have dominant male element, but also female one and vice versa. So the same in Kabbalism we speak about ten spheres on high, but also there are male and female, and everything is descending within each sphere. Within each aspect of each sphere, there are many. And so we can go to the infinite. So there are only 10 within 10. There are 10 within 10, but there are also couples within those 10. And it's very difficult even, you know, to keep in mind all the complexities which are possible in order to understand what's going on there. Because it's not a matter of understanding, it's a matter of how you apply it. That's very important, the application of all those issues. I gave you an example, I cannot enter too much. That was not pure theology. That I would like to make it very clear. Even when you speak about male and female, that's for sure not pure theology. You can imagine that something so central is not a theological situation, it's just theology. And that has an impact on the meaning of what's the feminine. And the status to a certain extent. I don't say that the Kabbalists are great, but good feminists. So, nevertheless, they had very important new elements which are very feminist. And very difficult to write about this. When you write about this, you're accused of being chauvinist. But that's the case. The case is that there are many, many discussions in which they say, what is it? Maybe no problem for the Kabbalists. To say it about God, for sure. About their wives, it's but to say in principle about equality, they have no problem with that extraordinary relations. They quoted time and again. I found at least 100 texts. Obvious, meaning written equal. Not that I can tell you that they are equal. So, those are implications which are not a matter of theology. Theology is important, but it is in a way inviting a certain reading of reality, of the Bible, of the commandments, you know, reality, you know. Major issues in rabbinical theology. You read them now in a symbolic manner. It's dealing with the highest divine sphere. And the highest divine sphere is not this pure mental monotheism, but something very dynamic and diverse and changing for. So, that is the beginning of an introduction to what's called inclusive theology. Because that's much more inclusive, and I shall speak later more about other kinds of inclusiveness. But what is important is that you can see that unlike the normal picture of the Kabbalists, and the traditionalists, orthodox, close-minded, which is, you know, running in many, many, many books about Kabbalah. I don't know, not all of the Kabbalists were the same, but major Kabbalists were much more open-minded, we can imagine. And it is not a matter of curiosity. It's not a matter of pluralism. It's a matter of attempting to offer an interpretation to Jewish life in a way which gives to this life a certain deep significance. That has to do with the divine sphere, the reflection of the divine sphere, and that's also an obligation for the divine sphere. So that's why to speak about theology is only a part of the story. To at least very strongly apply theology, attempting actually to offer a new vision which fortified basically the commandments, and to a very great extent, the Jewish elite who felt that they have an answer for questions. Why do they do it? That's the most important question for the medieval period. So, very nice that you are performing. And the rabbis couldn't offer an explanation why. They were inhibited by the fear that discussing why is going to marginalize the thoughts. If you invest so much in why, you don't do the what. And that is found from time to time in medieval period, not only the rabbis, you know, for sure, and I think it is so fun, but also in the Middle Ages, who were afraid of elaborating. So the Kabbalists were not afraid, and they offered this new dimension of reading all the aspects of fusion from a symbolic perspective, meaning as referring to a layer of reality which is very, very important and interactive, that creates now, that's an issue of the newspaper, also a new anthropology. It's not only a matter of new theology. Our assumption is a theology. This theology implied immediately a new anthropology. Well, first, what we are doing is very important. That's already anthropology. But we take the example of our body, it's 10 spheres. Each of us is male and female. So, actually, in a moment, you have another anthropology. Man became, in Kabbalistic culture, more and more divine. The soul, the body, there are a variety of versions, but there's no doubt that we're moving in one direction, and that man is becoming more and more and more divine, which is a deep change in anthropology. So here we have man, which had ramifications which are much beyond the theological speculations. That affected immediately the way in which the person is perceived. His actions are evaluated. And this is why this inclusiveness includes not only religion, also anthropology. It includes also how the cosmos is understood, male and female. Earlier, Jews didn't care about the cosmos too much. You know? It was okay around there, but then destroy it, waste of time to study. Let's speak about important issues. Now it's becoming a little bit a manifestation of that, having all those complications manifested also in the cosmos. Each part of the cosmos was created by a certain sphere. So understanding this relation is very important to understand the cosmos. So, what I attempted to offer until now, I don't deal with other issues at the moment, after me, is that the Kabbalists opened, in fact, didn't close theology by telling you a final form of theology. That's the theology, you know it, and today you open to the Kabbalah. You know Kabbalah, I know the 10 names, people have the feeling that they really know Kabbalah. That is even not a joke. That something really infantile. For a Kabbalist, all this story is evolving all the time in a variety of directions at the same time. Some of them being more complex than you can imagine. They are not only complete complexities, but also very weird ones, which are simply shocking that they can exist, and they existed without being criticized. That is the point. Because the sexuality became extremely important. The were Kabbalists crazy about it and writing about it, was, you know, in a way that no one will publish today something like that today. But the Kabbalists will write you openly. So there are new developments all the time in more than one direction, which turns the way in which we are looking for Kabbalah, this idea of this, you know, simply that's not a modest beginning, that's nothing. Even not the introduction to the introduction. So we're going to see other forms of complexity and inclusiveness in the afternoon when I shall speak about astrology. There's no reason to exclude it. But everyone adopted it, but many people did. And we shall speak about another trend in Kabbalah, which will include also, in addition to everything, the same Kabbalists will add also astrology and astromagic in addition to everything. Means that not someone going in this direction and living there. No, we're speaking about the same Kabbalists. Not all of them are taking everything, but many of them are taking many of those developments. Without feeling that's too much or too open.
not Jewish. That is problem of Orthodoxy. But think about it. Strictly Orthodox people. All of them. None of them was ever banned. Unlike Maimonides and Spinoza. He didn't have any problem similar to those guys. Anything. So we don't speak about fringes and don't speak about marginal figures. I think about the major figures in Jewish medieval figures, the major par excellence. I should give you examples, you know, to understand what the major figures. That major figures, by no one was more representative of Judaism than those figures. And never that they had any problem with many, many of the aspects. By the fact, I assumed they selected for their special reasons, a part of it. But not because they didn't like the other or believe the other aspects are regulatory. It's just they didn't find interesting. So here we have a move which is going on for several centuries and becoming more and more complex century after century. In a certain moment, it was so complex. Around 16th century, Kabbalists, it was a matter of economy, they couldn't keep in mind so much. So it calmed down, meaning it was not reduced, but the risk of complication became slower. Because it was good, people simply keep in mind all those details, and books were, in any case, huge books, thousands of pages. And to remember all those details, in human, then you must spend many, many years to study those details and enterprise them. So at a certain moment, let's say early 7th century, this multiplication of divine powers stopped to a certain extent. The risk became lender. I'm going to speak about what's called divine sparks, in a certain moment, divine sparks became what? Not ten, not thousands. No one knows. That became part of Julian theology, which is immediately continuing, in addition to everything I spoke earlier, ideas about millions of divine powers found here, and the implication for the ritual. So that is, to give you an example of what I'm going to speak about, complications which are much more than, let's say, some few dozen spheres. So we'll speak about something beyond whatever numbers we could speak earlier, and then also not the end. In a way, the end is the divinization of the cosmos. And if you go all the time, more and more and more and more, at that moment, you arrive to Spinoza, or you arrive to Pandis, which is beyond it you cannot complicate. I mean, yes, okay. Oh, you say everything is God, and God is found everywhere. So that's the end of this multiplication. But that is a very strong move, which this strong form of Pandis became later. As an inner development, as a logic of multiplying, multiplying, you multiply up to the moment, then it's very difficult to separate the divine from the non-divine. And that I shall discuss astronomy and astrology and these more ideas of divine presence within reality, more than one form, up to modern Hasidism or 18th century Hasidism, people say, God is found everywhere, every movement you do. This God is simply reality. And that's to a very great extent also Spinoza. So I am giving you only, anticipating a little bit what happens, you know, in the later phases, which are much more complex because they are not dislocating the earlier complications. Not at all. What is there is fine, but we are going one step beyond. And this one step beyond is again not only theology, it's also anthropology. Which means now that not we are divine, but are we, not only divine. So we have within ourselves all this complication, which creates new possibilities for understanding what is a person. We are not one. We are have everything. So let's say that we have in ourselves, I don't know, 613 and a quarter, I don't know what number it is, different personalities. Not two, not three, multiple personalities today is a small joke. People are speaking about having, I don't know how many thousands aspects in their soul, because in the soul is divine. So they are at the same time, Maimonides. I think about precise examples, not. We are Maimonides and anti-Maimonides. The same soul in the same time. Who can repair Maimonides? Because he didn't study Kabbalah. So the poor guy must be repaired. How do you repair? You claim this, you know, he's found in yourself, and then you study Kabbalah. Only Kabbalah, not philosophy, so to repair his soul. Just think about historical examples, not hypothetical examples. So, everything complicates also the human being and the way the human being is operating. Not operating just my personality and doing something, but okay, so I did my part. Actually, we are the end of a long line which includes everyone from Adam to Moses in ourselves. And who can be Moses, who can be Adam, depends when or what part of the day. To give you, you know, only the framework of what the meaning of complication. So, someone chooses to be whatever he would like to do, because he's studying one Kabbalist, so okay, I am, in a way, the soul of this Kabbalist, but I have an affinity to him, and today I'm working in such a way, and tomorrow a different way, and we have ideas of multiple personalities on a scale, an issue which we're not studying, on a scale which is much beyond whatever we can hear even today with all these new theories of personalities or multiple personalities. So what's multiple? Is it 2, 3, 4, 5? You know, that's maximum I can imagine. Normal companies speak about hundreds or thousands. And the problem is that at the same time you are working with all those personalities. How they work, they don't know. But that they are claiming openly, what is the case? And you can in your soul to have the opposites and to repair the opposites. Because that's your responsibility as a Kabbalist. That's why the reparation of the is so important. We made a big mistake and we should repair it. Is creating, in fact, an inner tension. Not only a theological tension on high, there are so many powers, and how do we explain it, and okay, let's go to sleep, and no, we go to sleep, you meet there, in yourself, all this complexity, in your dream. And that we have books, autobiographical books, all in the dream, in the dream. Everything comes to you, you can't escape it. So, this move is very, very inclusive. Now, a certain person includes all the people of Israel and all its history, which is amazing from the psychological point of view. Absolutely amazing how those people became crazy. They have all the time to operate with such a system, with such a big responsibility. With a lot of aspiration, with their money, however let's call it. And they had to operate, and they operated for many, many years, and they became crazy. They, I don't know about examples of Kabbalists who were diagnosed as crazy. And then, I will try to complicate, you know, more with this time, I don't know how much I can complicate more, but that's very important, not because of the details. It's very important also to understand that Kabbalah was something totally different than we imagine, you know, a simple esoteric story about 10 powers. And okay, you know, you understand. actually that is caritative, which is done for simple people who have a void in their life and they would like to have, you know, some more bizarre information. But what's going on in the books, when you read the books, you see a picture which is so much beyond that. That's why I decided this, because you are inclusive theology. That is inclusive theology. More inclusive than you can imagine, not Trinitarian, not Pan, but more and more and more. I cannot offer you even numbers. What numbers are modest. I don't want to calculate even how many personalities there was in a certain Kabbalist, what he admitted, not what I was. Because that's no end. So here we have an other theological approach. That's open theology, process theology, how would I like to call it? I'm calling it inclusive theology. But that's not only theology, that's also religion. That is applied theology. No matter how bizarre it can be, it is always applied. No one is writing theology for the sake of theology. That was not the Jewish enterprise. So, but if you remember what's very, very important, incoherence is the clue for understanding. Otherwise, we as scholars became crazy. If we assume there was a order there, and we attempt to find this order, or in other terms, to harmonize, to say, those scholars had something in the secret, which they didn't disclose to us, and I must find this as a scholar, this secret, that will unify all those interpretations together, I should become crazy. So my solution to it is deep incoherence. The assumption that there are ways of thinking which are not Western, which don't build on contradictions. Which is that vision. Either you have this theology, it's correct or not correct. It's not correct, it's correct. And no one will go to have at the same time more than one theology. If you work on such an assumption, Kabbalah makes no sense. If you work with another vision, much more open, which is not dictated by Aristotelian logic, which doesn't care about conclusion, then you can be more relaxed, more open, and I hope to understand better what's going on there. Otherwise, we are looking for the hidden clue. We are not going to find it ever. Okay, now we have time for grand rules. So you have some questions, or that's a few things for you.
I have a question. You said that, let me say, God needs us.
I said, Kabbalist.
Okay. Can you explain a little bit more? In what sense? Because it is clear to me one point, but it's a little bit different. The assumption that man is cooperating in the process of creation. But this is one point.
Yes.
And I think it's a little bit different to say that God needs us to survive, so to say.
What? In fact, God had a small purpose. He created without us. That's a big question for the Kabbalists. How can God create without us? That's a question the Kabbalists ask often. What was the element that triggered God to do something? Because for them it was obvious that man is the trigger. Ask the question that happened after the sixth day. You know, how did God do something without any trigger? Man was not around. So there are a lot of explanations tending to say that in a way God thought about us, and that is the trigger. Because otherwise he won't do it. So from the very beginning that's the problem. From the moment man was created, everything is created. All the good and bad things depend on us. So, okay, so we can blame us or not, but that's it. But the real problem is 6 days of creation. Without man, why? What is God doing there without us? So that is creation. But the problem is not that God needs us for creation. That is okay, so we will not around it anyways. The problem is how to continue this process. And that is cooperation, not only for creation. It is cooperation for the normal existence of the universe. Now, God, so let's take an image, which is not of the Kabbalist, but can easily understand. Let's say that electricity plant, which has an infinite number of small branches. We have the circuit of the plant. We supply God to energy to the central, and the central is internal, and up and down, up and down. In the moment you don't have any branch, the central is going to disappear. Stop. You can ask, wait a minute, what's going to happen to God? Where is going to disappear? So the Kabbalists are describing, you remember, the spherot above the spherot. The lower spherot, which were the manifestation versus us, if we don't do our part, they are absorbed within the higher part. God doesn't disappear, but the manifested part of God is reabsorbed within the highest. And for us, it disappears. No, that he's there. For us, it's here. But it means that we disappear. Not only he disappears there, also we disappear here. So we must make all the time an effort to keep this manifestation of God active. Because otherwise, we disappear. So that's not only a matter of the time of creation, we did our part, and now God is taking control, and we are in good shape. No, that is a matter of every commandment. Every commandment is necessary. The problem is that not too many people in the world are committing the commandments, are from the commandments. That's a big problem. That's why it doesn't work. Look what's going on around. The world doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Because we didn't do our part, and we inflicted a lot of damage on the system. So that's why Kabbalah is so important, because it's repairing everything. And keeping, to a certain extent, the system helping. So that's not only cooperation in creation. It is much more. It is sustaining the universe daily. That's why the idea of obligation or responsibility, which is the meaning for the commandment, is so attractive for the rabbis. Because they say, look, that's more you cannot say about the commandment. That's the maximum. God needs it. The universe needs it. For sure we need that. You cannot say, ah, that's my private story. I don't perform the commandment, I go to hell. My problem. I don't care. But that's not your problem at all. You are a small particle in any case. The problem is universal. It's divine. I mean, you cannot say, I know, I don't play the game. I'm tired. No, you know, there's no way to be tired. You know, that's simply responsible. So that is, in my opinion, the fascinating part of Kabbalah. It creates a new anthropology of daily responsibilities. It's not I'm responsible, you know, when I'm coming there to paradise, maybe the account will see. Meanwhile, I feel confidence. I cannot be confident, meaning you must do it all the time for you, right? All your time. If you stop doing one commandment, you inflicted something on the spot. No way to be misunderstood. One small sin is one more damage. Yes.
When you spoke concerning the commandments,
yes.
As you know, as a Christianity view, there is a little bit a point between the two first commandments,
yes,
which are very clear,
yeah,
and then the other one,
yes,
which seems to be you have to do,
yeah,
you have to not to do,
yeah,
and this separation between you know better than I that Moses and everything, the separation between these two commandments and the other one, who is seen in this, because it's a very different between the two and the other one.
So what is commandment? Commandment in biblical and Arabic place are two forms of commandments. They are positive and negative. What we should do, what you should not do. Both of them are as important as that. By doing what you do, you repair. By transgressing what you shouldn't do, you cannot. So that is the general structure. The general structure is that all of them are important. You cannot say what I do is important, what I don't do is not important. No, what you don't do, you're blaming by not doing, because every moment, so, the image, to take the image of the Kabbalists. So don't be short, this was my image. The Kabbalists are saying that we are the body. The God is our shadow. By moving our hands, we move the divine. If we don't do it, there's going to be a stasis there. What is the commandment? You know how to move the hand in a correct way in order to help the divine acting in the right way. That's a strong image. Not my image. Found tens of times from the beginning of Kabbalah, Rafi's, I believe it's rabbinic, it's another case of inclusion, rabbinic story, running up to Hasidus. Now, that you don't do, for sure you don't do, it's fine, but when you transgress and you perform something against the interdiction, that is the So we have the same balance. So that's right. What you don't do is fine, but you transgress an interdiction. That is the big rupture in the divine. You are simply introducing a rupture in the system. The spheres are not united. Divine power will descend in the system, doesn't descend. The channel is stopped, is cut. So, there's no big difference between positive commandment and negative commandment. Both of them are in the books on the rationals of the commandment, you have discussions of both of them at length. No. So what you ask, that's another question, it's a small question. The ten commandments, it's small detail. They don't operate too much with the commandments. They operate in with 600 and much more, if you speak. So the fact that the two commandments are just a matter of belief. That's okay, so for what? Significant for them, you should worship the God. Don't have appetites. Okay, but that's not the answer. It's not the issue. It's small detail. So you have enough commandments, In any case, two others that are more mental or a matter of belief, right? Small part of it. It's not two out of ten. It's two out of minimum 630. It's only the beginning of the calculation. So you have two commandments which are okay, don't do it. Yes. Wait, who was it?
I was wondering about this thing of incoherence and to expect it as a way of relaxing with a different reality.
Yeah.
And. Yeah. And on the other side, the need, the goal to unify.
Yes.
Those.
Yeah.
And. Somewhere the question is, if I relax totally,
If you are.
If I relax totally.
Yes.
Will I lose something in the tension of getting united with God, also with the meaning, also with the making together of the difference?
You have seen ever a relaxed you? That's not an issue, you know. What do you mean if you relax? You relax, you don't do something. You don't do. If you don't do, you don't contribute. If you feel well, that's no way. You can feel well or not. You know, Papa said nothing against being feeling well, or being relaxed. But that's, you know, that's a personal, emotional, transient moment. That's, you know, that's irrelevant. You know, what you say is irrelevant. You have to be relaxed, better. And that's for sure not the concept of Kabbalists. Be relaxed or not to be relaxed. At least the vast majority of the words. It's a small problem. You have to be relaxed. Right? But you must concentrate very strongly. It's in all the time of this issue. If you can't do it while relaxed, it's very nice. But they don't want to address it because that's, you know, it is too, for them, personal and trivial. Or if you look in the system of the Bible and rabbinic texts and also the Kabbalists. Commandments are not a matter of your state of mind. That's something you must do if you are happy or sorry. Yeah, that may save you from anything. With some very, very few exceptions during 7 days of, let's say, of Shiva or somewhere in the morning. So we don't have to perform all the commandments. Some commandments for 7 days are accepted. But normal life, no one can say, look, this morning I am sad. I don't go to the synagogue. I'm sad. Sorry. No way. That's, you know, I'm happy. So I'm going to be happy. That's a question. You are happy or sad, that is your story. And that's not only Kabbalah, that is rabbinic, that's a way of life, that's not a way of feeling. Your feeling is your problem, you must deal with your feeling, you know, by yourself. The system doesn't recognize something else. Now I'm happy, I shall perform some more commandments. Tomorrow I'm sad, let's subtract some 10 of them. People will say, you're simply crazy. You are mingling two different issues, the personal, transient feeling, with something which is immensely important. And you are claiming now, because my emotion is a little bit disturbed, they don't do my part. So, you will say, for sure, it's better to be happy and be relaxed. They are Kabbalists. Including Italian Kabbalists, saying, it's very important, like in Hasidus later, to be joyful. Joyful and happy. The Kabbalists saying, but it doesn't mean that if you are not, you can do something else. You know, we are accepted because, you know, your mood was different later. Irrelevant. In Hasidus, it changed a little bit. Not too much. Change. But basically, the rabbinic tradition is very, very clear about it. The moments you are exempt for are very, very rare and regulated in a very precise manner. You cannot decide when you do or don't do because of your state of mind. No way.
And the point was not very much also this, because also this, but on the attitude between accepting things as they are,
yes.
So in a way to relax with things as they are, or to try to find a unity between things.
So, things as they are bad. That's obvious. Meaning anyone who feels what happened in the reality, especially for the Jews, didn't make mistakes about the situation. It's true. It was very easy to see that everything should be repaired. So you cannot accept things as they are. As they are,
is obvious a little bit. So you must move into a certain direction. Not say, it's very bad, but now I'm doing this dukkha in the morning. Because in any case, it's bad. No, that's your meaning. That is a commitment to repair or to amend reality. You don't say, look, bad enough. What can I do? Not too much. So let's not do all this. Say, simply, your face, it's bad, and that's your commitment to repair it, even in a modest way. The most modest way doesn't become modest. It is your.
Thank you.
Found in the system of experience. These are the anthropomorphic ones, which assumes that within the divine sphere there are configurations called faces. So the Hebrew term is taken from Greek, patu, prosopon, which are a special type of theology within the 10 sphere system. So no more questions. So I must complicate even more.
I have got a couple of options. One is you give us some very interesting glimpses into history of ideas. For instance,
yes.
Emanation appears for the first time in Wisdom of Solomon, and then it's our problem to see whether this cannot be connected with Neoplatonism. But the first is there. And also the idea that it is possible in this useful to give motivation for the commandment appears for the first time in Kabbalah.
And it's systematically.
Yes, and it's our problem to say whether it's how rabbinic Judaism goes along without it.
Yes.
And I would be extremely interested in a more systematic treatment of Kabbalah as relating to the history of ideas, because obviously there are many important ideas which came into the history of Western culture through Kabbalah.
So how can I answer all those questions in one small course?
I would be grateful for your bibliography too.
Unfortunately, my biography is very modest.
Because
didn't write about Kabbalah, they wrote from another perspective. So, as to Wisdom of Solomon and Profanus. Yeah, that's a real question. The assumption that Profanus was, a Greek philosopher who didn't know about today's medicine, was not influenced at all, pagan figure, it's true, but incomprehensible. To give you a major example, one of the most important students of Plotinus was called Origen, who knew a lot about Philo and about doing stuff in Alexandria. The question is not if he could know. The problem is, was he influenced? Slowly, we see more that yes. Because of a certain fascination of the Western scholars with Greek culture as self-contained, people had the feeling that from Plato, Platonism, and Plotinus. That's not so simple. In the middle, there was some, like Numenius, who's quoting Moses out of the blue. Yes, Hegel, Neoplatonism. Yesterday I spoke about Gandhi was coming from, but there are many Semitic figures in your practice. Some of them were around. Now, that doesn't mean that Philo was known, but Philo was known to Origen. Now, many years ago, if you can have a look in Kabbalah, you will see that I attempted to say even Muyo Mystica is Philo. Now, I must say, I'm sure, for reasons, that's the same with the other part of the question. Kabbalah is available for ideas in the West. It was not studied
problem to show. Not a problem at all. This lady gave me some books yesterday. He can easily show how people in 16th century who studied Hebrew, that posterity. Integrated a lot of Kabbalistic stuff in legal systems. Few of those Jewish elementary who met as such. But that is posterity. And then moved to another field who studied in Rabbi, who translated in French. Important book in French. Part of it Kabbalistic, part of it now. So studied by many people in Paris. And then you have in the Pleiades, nice people arriving French poetry. They're writing after La Ronnie du Monde was published in Paris. Huge book, I don't know, 600 folios in French, published in Paris.
600 folios. No. Oh, page. Page. No. Just one book. Look, that's one book. No, no, no. Give me an example. One book. There are many other examples. It was written in French, and, you know, translated in French, and published in Paris. So there are a lot of new developments in French culture. People won't say that there's something to do with Kabbalah because they never read this book anymore. It's simple as that. People are innocent. I can give you many, many examples. Just to take French culture. You've heard about someone named Madame. That's a French people. Purely French. But you don't understand. From war, it's all his play with the believer. You combine in one way or another. People are crazy about them. So what is the source? Nothing in French literature, very rationalistic.
Excuse me, has this, is that any book that was written anything about La Ronnie du Monde and Mallarmé?
No, I didn't say that. Mallarmé is another example, not that one. There's another story. It's not about the Pleiades and La Ronnie.
Yes. Has any book...
It's my reading, you know. It's my true reading. Unfortunately, I told you I tend to give you the biography. That's why I'm telling you, I don't want to give you the biography, that's all. Mallarmé, give me more despair, you know, it's still a despair, a dear guy, an Englishman, came with an idea. Maybe it's Kabbalistic. Just a simple idea, because there are a lot of books on Kabbalah published in French in the 19th century, there's no problem at all. And then if you read a little bit his correspondence, you find Kabbalah. Open it. You don't have to guess. It's written there. So, if you don't make the effort, you don't see it. So, how many people who work in French literature read seriously the Bible? Would that be more? Get it there. You know, that's
yes.
Anti-Kabbalistic. See, copy verbatim. Verbatim from Kabbalistic sources. Verbatim, I can show you the source. Verbatim, letter by letter. When I said to him, told me not true. Let's recite again. So what? It's obviously copies verbatim, quoting from Kabbalah without reading the source, verbatim. That even he denied it's true. So what? Here is proof. I can give you how many examples you like. That's simply not a problem. There are so many, meaning even people who deny it openly. Not like they did at a certain moment deny it. Maybe Nazis denied Kabbalah. Out of the blue, in one day, he's writing the introduction to a very important Kabbalistic book. Which he studied all his life because he's Lithuanian. And that's the book of Kabbalah in Lithuania. Now, out of the blue, he's writing an introduction in French. After he denied all the time. So, what do you do with the fact? The fast and all this stuff which appears, you remember, I speak about the face. Through that, I spoke about the face. So, just living us. Who denied all his life that he studied Kabbalah? So on, you could have to give you more and more examples. That, you know, even if you take one single culture, the French one, I can show you major moments.
major. Which is not difficult at all. But it has to be a little bit.
No problem.
Then it's very simple. So, the Nobel biography, unfortunately, because scholars of Kabbalah don't read French. And people who read French don't read Kabbalah. So we still are in this, also in Italy.
Probably you wouldn't need to be a scholar of Kabbalah to read French because Mallarmé probably did not read Kabbalah in the original. Or did he?
No, he didn't read it.
Yes. So you only have to go to the Bibliothèque Nationale and read the French books that Mallarmé can have read.
That's good.
So you don't read, you don't have to read.
So I was in the Bibliothèque Nationale and I read Mallarmé de Monde when it appeared in the new French edition. Early 80s by Antoine Fevre. Yes, so that's what you do, you know. It's not so complicated. No, it's uneasy to go to the National, very uneasy. But if you are serious, you do it. You don't, you know, so you speculate about it. So for sure it's very difficult to go to the National and takes you half a day to only to. You know, then you don't
have
a place.
I'm not that bad, come on.
Believe me. You know.
I go there regularly.
Now, the music.
I know.
I decided not to read there, but to go to the manuscript.
Let's do that.
Because there were no one. But to read in the reading room, at the moment they bring from Versailles a book, you must pay, I don't know how many nights of hotel. Because they must do the book on their side.
Yes, that's true, but have you ever tried Italian libraries? They're much worse.
I don't think about the bad libraries. I have good libraries. So they have better libraries, but that's you know, a small story.
British library.
The real story is that appeared in France then. La Rémy du Monde, the new edition of Antoine Fevre. So I couldn't go to the British library. So, for sure it's difficult, but it's not impossible, you know. How to be beyond our reach, and the fact that people didn't do it has to do with the Eurocentric vision of European culture, which slowly is dissipating. Read Mobilian, read Umberto Eco, read even the later era, not the earlier, but the later era. You see that this picture is dissipating. Don't take a lot of time, for sure. But that's not, you know, 10 years ago, everyone knew Pico knew Kabbalah, Piccino didn't know Kabbalah. He was a scholar living in Florence, wrote a small article showing how Piccino is coping. But wait, not one phrase, not two phrases, the column. So that takes time, scholarship, hard work. And when you have it, you publish, you would like to publish in a very, very respectable book, Journal of Renaissance. Such a major finding is rejected. That's impossible. It's impossible that it's repeated. You know, columns, there's no way to discuss it at all. It should be published on the spot in the door. Out of the blue, it's rejected. So that is a phenomenon which has to do with a strong Eurocentric Greek-Roman centralization of culture. We didn't recognize, to a very great extent, the Jewish part and the other magical part, for example, which is slowly entering. A lot of things were marginalized. And our picture is very sublime, mental, theological, exclusive. Because that's why I'm speaking about inclusive theology, which is not the cup of tea of the West.
Okay.